Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Good afternoon and welcome to this Wednesday edition of the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I'm Bill O'Brien. It is a Wednesday. It is the 12th day of February. It used to be a school holiday when I was in grade school because it's Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Now, of course, you know that we have, for purposes of long weekends, we have combined George Washington's birthday, February 22nd, and Lincoln's February 12th into an amorphous new creation called President's Day. And we always celebrate it on a Monday. But today is the day, the 12th of February, the day that Abraham Lincoln was born. It is also the third day of our program here at the Virtual Center this week. And I just want to basically take a moment to thank you and thank Bob Kincaid and the folks at Head On Radio Network for the opportunity to present yet another week of programming here on Head On Radio Network for the Virtual Center. I invite you to participate actively in our program. I want to talk about that in a moment. By giving us a call, we have a phone number that we have reserved for exclusively for purposes of getting you on the air so that we can share your ideas, your thoughts, your perspectives with our listeners. The area code is 304, and the number is 658-3333. That's area code 304-658-3333. If you would like to email me directly, by all means, I invite you to do that. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. Yesterday, as you will remember, we began our program an hour early because I had an engagement last evening here in the Beckley area with our Rotary Club. We had a regular weekly meeting of our Rotary Club on Tuesday evening last night. Usually we meet at noon on Tuesdays. It's kind of interesting, just as an aside. The club, the first 15, 17 years that I was in the club, we used to meet regularly on Tuesday evenings. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, the president that year, after doing some extensive surveys and checking in with a number of other clubs in the area, decided because we were having rather poor attendance at our meetings, that maybe we ought to consider changing our meetings from a dinner meeting on Tuesdays to a luncheon meeting. And that way we would have a better chance of getting some of the younger folks in the community, professionals who, once they go home in the evening at 5 o'clock, aren't really inclined to turn around and go out again to attend a Rotary meeting once they get involved in their kids' soccer and basketball and all the rest of it. So we changed our meetings to noon meetings a number of years ago. And as a result of that, we lost a number of our regular old-timer members who really didn't want to change and wanted to maintain the evening meeting. And, of course, we made the point with them that you can't maintain a club and plan for the viability of that club in the future when you cater to the priority interests of some of the older folks who are retired and really can attend a meeting, whether it be in the evening or at noon, but that what we were trying to do was grow the club with some younger folks. And so we were making this change. And we did pick up a number of new members, but that was offset in large degree by the number of older folks who stopped coming. Anyway, last evening, to celebrate Valentine's Day this week, we had a special dinner. We had it in the evening. We had a cash bar and ribeye steaks, and it was just wonderful. But anyway, my point is that in the course of conversation over dinner, I was sitting with a good friend, and his wife. And my wife and I were sharing experiences. It so happens that this particular friend is a minister here in the area, and he married my wife and I seven years ago this March. And we've been very good friends ever since. And anyway, we were talking about the program, about the virtual center. He was asking me a number of questions about the virtual center and about the program. And I shared with him the fact that we're on 3 days a week for 2 hours each day. And that he asked me if it was an interactive program. And I said, in theory, it is. But the reality is that for most days, it usually ends up being a monologue because I really haven't been getting any calls. I get some wonderful emails from people who basically say, and I appreciate it so much, that they find the information so worthwhile that they're reluctant to call and interfere or break a train of thought or anything like that. And while I appreciate that, the fact of the matter is, it effectively, if it's a monologue day after day after day, then what we're talking about is a 2 hour one way presentation 3 days a week, which is fairly significant in terms of investment of time, planning time and research time and all the rest of it. And so I was telling him that I really would like to find ways to generate more conversation, more interaction here at the virtual center. I know it will come eventually, but I don't want it to come so late that we'll exhaust what I think is the more interesting aspects of the program, which are the insights and the information itself related to the Constitution, related to the founders, and related to the priorities and the decisions of the Supreme Court, etc. And so my friend suggested, and this came after a conversation, we were talking about the books we were reading, and I mentioned a book that I've been reading, although I'm not making nearly the progress on it that I should be, and we've made reference to it here at the Virtual Center, called Who Owns the Future? And it's about the digital revolution and what it's doing in terms of technological advances and what it's doing to our education system, and more importantly, in the short term, what it's doing to our employment prospects. Basically, what this technology and this digitization of information, the translation of information into data, into raw data, what is called metadata, which is numbers coded in numbers, the sum total is it's having, you know, a very serious effect on people's prospects for employment, because the data and the technology is becoming so sophisticated that it's making it less and less possible for people to catch up. And especially when you look at it in the context of our current practices in the field of education, it's become very clear that our education system is in no way preparing young people for the kind of world that we are witnessing here with such rapid technological change. We talked last week about a book called The Second Machine Age, and we talked about the fact that that revolution in technology is happening at such a rapid rate that it's becoming more and more impossible for people to keep up. And so consequently, what we're dealing with is fewer and fewer people who can really maintain currency with the technological change and the pace of that change. Anyway, my friend suggested that what we might think about doing here at the Virtual Center, and I thought it had pretty good It was a pretty good idea, so I thought I'd throw it out for your consideration. I would love to hear from you, either on the phone. We have the phone number, which is 304-658-3333, or in a personal email to me, if that works better for you. What Bob suggested was that we take a book like Who Owns the Future and schedule 3 or 4 weeks out the devotion of some time here at the virtual center to a discussion of that book. And that would give everybody time to obtain a copy or secure a copy from their library or whatever, put it on Kindle, which is what I did. It's very, very reasonable. I think it's about $9 or something on Kindle. And give everybody a chance to read it or at least read into it. And then we could devote at least one program and maybe more than one to a discussion of that book. And then we could basically select another book and do that 3 or 4 weeks out from then. And what we would have would be, every 3 or 4 weeks we would devote our program here to discussions, to book reviews. I thought it was a pretty good idea. I thought that at the beginning of the program today, I'd kind of throw it out and try to get your thoughts as to what you think about this idea, whether you would think it might work. Obviously, there's nothing to prohibit folks who are unable to read the book for a number of reasons to tune in and listen to the discussions. We have to assume that the discussions and the interaction would be valuable programming in and of itself. And of course,
and I don't understand why. And a little later on the program, we're going to talk about a couple of stories that have popped up of, you just go, really? How is that possible in this day and age? But And it's interesting that these numbers pop out today, because, I had this conversation with my dentist and the hygienist, and they were saying, well, nobody's signing up for it, it's a failure. And I'm going, you know how long it took for Medicare to get to the point to where it's at now? I mean, it was like 18 years before all the states actually bought into it. It was a long process. And at the beginning, there were a lot of bugs, there were a lot of things that had to be worked out, and I see the Affordable Care Act in the exact same light. It's a step in the right direction. And by the end of our conversation, like always, I think my dentist just happy to get rid of me, collect my check and move on. But he began, oh, yeah, you're right. I'm not sure if it was patronizing or if he actually understands that he's wrong, like many of my Tea Party friends. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Have you heard about the Great Chicago Pension Caper? The Chicago Teachers Union says it's happening as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel tries to negotiate with the union at the point of a gun. The Teachers Union says in the midst of these negotiations, Illinois State Senator John Cullerton is launching a salvo that could be the start of the Great Chicago Pension Caper. Cullerton is estimating future pension cuts for teachers. The Chicago Teachers Union says the city is threatening to lay off 3,000 teachers and raise student class sizes. The union vows to defend retirement security for educators in Chicago. The union says pensions are not gifts. They are earned through labor by workers who expect the money to be there as promised. The union says the pension problem in Illinois is a revenue problem, not an expenses problem. Chicago schools are making a budgeted pensions payment of $613 million to the pension fund by June 30th. But between 1995 and 2005, the Chicago district made no pension payments. Teachers and other municipal employees in Chicago are going to the Illinois State Capitol February 19th to, quote, encourage legislators not to raid their benefits while their wealthy corporate allies reap the financial benefits of their hard labor, end quote. Republican Tennessee U.S. Senator Bob Corker is urging VW workers in Chattanooga to vote against joining the UAW this week. Corker flip-flopped from his original public position, which was that the decision is in the hands of the workers and it would be inappropriate for him to comment until they vote. UAW Region 8 Director Gary Castile says it's sad that when workers exercise their legal right to form a union, Tennessee politicians like Corker threaten the economic well-being of communities and businesses just because workers want to have a voice in the future of Volkswagen in Chattanooga. Castile says it's unfortunate
that Senator Corker has been swayed by special interests from outside of Tennessee to flip-flop on his position on what's best for Chattanooga's working families. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, are voting Wednesday through Friday on whether or not to have UAW represent them, a vote that's expected to have a significant impact on union organizing at foreign-owned auto plants throughout the South. Castile says the decision should be left to the workers. VW is neutral on the union vote and has urged third parties to stay out of it. But right-wing anti-union groups are waging a public campaign against the VW workers joining the UAW.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News is the only national daily radio newscast focused on workers and their unions to help keep those voices on the radio. Donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize that the way that you
you better do what you're told. You better do it. Okay, whatever you hear about from the right wingers, you better do it. Those unions, bad for you. They're horrible. You know, actually having a voice on the job, you don't need that headache, do you? At least that's what we're told. And I look at what's going down in Tennessee right now, and it is just mind-blowing how the corporate class and their political puppets are attacking a worker's right to choose. And then all of the veiled and unveiled threats that are going along with it. I mean, I look at Corker coming out and saying, well, you know, if the workers decide that they're going to join the union, they're going to move the plant or they're going to make something somewhere else. And just all kind of fear-mongering by a state senator, a U.S. senator. I mean, it's, although I guess I shouldn't be surprised when you look at the clout and the power that we give these huge corporations and these extraordinarily wealthy people. And I look at what's going on out in Pittsburgh and Altoona with UPMC, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. This huge corporation that we've allowed to grow to really a behemoth size. And what has been going on with their workforce the last several months at least. And yesterday, in fact, the nurses at one of the places in Blair County went on a one-day strike to highlight the fact that the contract negotiations not going well, which is why we've asked Kim Heverly. She is one of the RNs that works at the UPMC out there in Altoona. Kim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I see this story that, you know, that the nurses went on a one-day strike. Tell me, how did we get to this point?
We began our contract negotiations back in October. This is the first time that we've actually had to negotiate with UPMC. They bought us in July, and that was the beginning of something that was very new for us that we embarked on. The contract negotiations were very different than what we've ever been through, and we probably spent over the past several months 8 hours across the table from management, which is very unreal, not a lot of give and take, and they pretty much were gutting our contract, taking away our power to negotiate or grieve things, and one of the most grievous things is our patient care numbers, and they want to take away the guidelines that we have for staffing and anything that they did keep. They didn't want us to be able to advocate for our patients. They didn't want us to have a voice. And so we've been bargaining hard with them, and we had issued the strike notice because things were breaking down, but they said they would come back to the table. Unfortunately, they talked to us. They only wanted to talk about retirement and health care. That was it. They didn't want to discuss anything else, and they pretty much forced us to had to take the action for the one-day unfair labor practice strike that we had yesterday.
So, you know, because I say I've been saying for the longest time, look, a strike is the last resort. It's when everything's kind of broken down, and it's kind of the arrow in the quiver that you hope gets people back together and say, hey, you know, both we're serious. We need to be sitting down and talking. And I guess I'm not surprised that UPMC or really any of these behemoth corporations would want to just impose upon their workforce and not actually sit down and honestly and in good faith negotiate with them.
Absolutely, and that we have felt very disrespected and, you know, that they just weren't really interested in what we had to say. It was going to be their way or the highway.
Well, let me take a step back for a second because, you know, you said this is the first time you've negotiated with UPMC. Who did you work for before UPMC bought them? What was the entity before, and what was the relationship like with them prior to UPMC coming into the picture?
It was called Altoona Regional Health Systems, and it was a merged system between two hospitals in Altoona, Pennsylvania. We were an Altoona hospital and a Bon Secours Holy Family hospital that had joined together. And we had, over the past 6 years, built a very good working relationship with our management team. I am one of the vice presidents, and we were able to sit down and talk and get things worked out. We've never had to even take anything to arbitration. We felt we had a very good working relationship.
And that's, to me, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, we hear an awful lot from the right, the political right in our country, that unions are just adversarial and they just want to butt heads. But every story that I heard, and I've talked to so many people like you, Kim, who say, you know, we want to sit down, we want to negotiate, we want our place of employment to be the best it can be, not just for ourselves and our coworkers, but also for the company itself, so that it prospers, we all prosper together. And I keep hearing the other side of it, the adversarial relationship that has sprung up is management saying, you will do, I'm going to impose, and I don't know how that's a two-way street, and that's a good relationship at all.
Right, right, it's not, and we're looking at it as, you know, Goliath and David, essentially, right now.
So it's they're that big, they feel they have that kind of control. So yesterday, you guys, the nurses went out on strike for a one-day unfair labor practice strike just to get their attention. What happened today when you went back to work?
Whenever we had hundreds of nurses prepared to return to their jobs today, and the hospital sort of sits on a hill, and the nurses walk together as a group, and midway up the hill were met by hospital police, and they indicated
Hold on. You were met by the hospital police?
Yes. The hospital police were there, and they indicated if you were on strike and you had been called back by your manager, you were welcome. And if you were on a strike and had not been called back by your management, you have been temporarily replaced and should not return to work until your manager calls you. And
wow.
At one point, someone asked to speak with someone from management, and he said, I am management today. So
that's what the cop said?
Yes.
Really? I can't imagine being in that situation and wanting to be any part of that, because don't you guys have to work together tomorrow or the day after? I mean, that just, again, this whole situation, from top to bottom, this company is basically putting poison in the entire workforce as I see it.
They are, and they're trying to make adversarial relationships throughout the facility, but if anything, for the most part, it has made us stronger. The registered nurses are bonded. It was a show of force that I will never soon forget. It was history made in Altoona, Pennsylvania yesterday.
And that's, you know, that's fantastic. What I find most heartening, if that's the right word, the best part of this is that people are standing together shoulder to the shoulder. And to me, once you know, you go back to the days, you know, 100 years ago, when, you know, they would bring out strike breakers with clubs, people still stood together. And I think we need to see that again today, Kim.
Yes, we do. And our community is behind us as well. I can't tell you, yesterday and today, there was food, coffee, donuts delivered to us, on the strike line, there were cars constantly going up and down, just beeping their horn in support. We've had other unions come and stand with us, community members, other employees from the hospital. If they were off or after their shifts, were out there standing with us, our family members. It's just been an amazing thing.
And it's that kind of solidarity, not just in your workplace, but in the community, that I think our country is desperately in need of.
Yes. And our area in particular is really being hit hard. So we need to show that.
But I look at a big outside entity like UPMC, which, as I understand, in the Altoona area, they're an outside entity, correct?
Yes, yes. They've moved into our community.
Yeah, that they've come in, and now they're basically destroying working conditions and wages, not just for where you're at, but I would say probably the whole industry in your area, that because they're that big and that powerful.
Yes, they are the largest employer now in Blair County.
Wow. And I would guess, even though I know they have a nonprofit status, I would guess they are extraordinarily profitable.
Absolutely.
With a CEO who doesn't have to eat store brand cheese and macaroni.
As a matter of fact, he doesn't even have to fly commercial. They have a corporate jet.
I think that speaks volumes. The fact that, and again, I go back to, you know, part of the problems with our healthcare system as a whole is that you have people like this CEO who fly around on corporate jets, where the money that we're handing to him should be paid to the hardworking people who are taking care of us when we're at our most vulnerable. That, to me, is disgraceful, that we see these corporate jets and these huge salaries and all of this money on lavish this and that, when we should be paying, you know, the people who are cleaning up after us, the people who are taking care of our loved ones and our most vulnerable. It's, I got to be honest, it's disgusting to me.
Yes, it is.
So where do you go tomorrow? I understand you had the one-day strike. Now, they I guess they've kind of like a lockout almost. Because the way I look at it is you guys were locked out. They didn't let you come back to work. They've kicked you to the curb. What happens tomorrow?
Well, they are transitioning, as they like to call it. So there are a few of our nurses that are getting called back in bits and pieces. But then those of us who are not are going to board buses tomorrow morning, and we are going to take our picket line to Pittsburgh.
Nice.
And we are going to be there on Grant Street, and we want them to hear us, because we understand and we see that those decisions are being made in Pittsburgh. They're not being made in Altoona.
Yeah, and what bothers me is, and it's interesting you brought that up, because I would have to guess that the local management that you've had in place, that you've had a good relationship over the years. Do you think that they're comfortable with this? Do you think that they're happy that, you know, because they've got to be there the day after and the day after and the day after. What's your sense of that, how it going forward?
You know, it's hard to read them. They've been pretty well quiet. You know, they're coming out now and speaking to the media a little bit in bits and pieces here. But even during our negotiations, their lead negotiator did all of the speaking. And the rest of the team, if they had to speak or needed to speak on something, they generally looked to him for permission. So I don't think they're comfortable with it. Of course, none of them have said anything to us, but it's definitely been a different relationship than what we were used to 6 months ago.
And that's no good. And that's no good for your patients. That's no good for the people who depend on the continuity of care and the experience that you nurses bring to the table.
Absolutely. And that's part of the whole issue, is that what we're negotiating for is to maintain what we have, and they're stripping away things that are going to retain and recruit these experienced nurses. And a lot of the nurses in this facility have put 20, 30 years. When you see nurses that are retiring, it's 30-plus years when they do retire. They've dedicated their entire career to this because it's a community hospital. It truly is. It was built by our founding railroad workers.
So it was built by the railroad workers, and now it's owned by a huge corp. That's an injustice right there.
Yes.
I mean, just the fact that and I guess this has happened all across the country as we've taken healthcare from being something that we in the community, we the people, provide to and for ourselves, to something now that is a drain from our local economy and a profit motive for someone else.
Yes, and you know, our union chapter president has said, you know, healthcare has changed, and now as registered nurses, we have to advocate differently. You know, they're calling our patients clients, they're calling our facilities business units. And so, you know, nurses who 10, 15, 20 years ago never thought they would be walking a picket line have now found out that the best way to advocate for our patients in this day and age is maybe to have to take that step. And it was a very hard decision.
Yeah, I can imagine, because, you know, I've met in my years, I've spent a lot of time with relatives in hospitals, and the people that I absolutely trust the most are those frontline nurses who are with my grandmother, for instance, when she goes in for her problems. Those are the doctors, you know, you take, they're in and out. I take, and I trust the nurses much more than I do the doctors, which I guess is probably not a smart thing to say or the right thing to say, but it's just the truth.
Well, we're there 24/7. You know, we are the eyes and the ears of the doctor, and we're the ones that catch those little things that are small clues and, you know, alert them to things that are going on so that we can save lives every day. And we are sacrificing time at home with our families, holidays. You know, people don't realize there's been a lot of things on Facebook and, you know, you should be glad you have a job and all those kinds of rhetoric. And it's like, you don't know what we sacrifice every day, day in and day out, meal breaks, bathroom breaks, holidays, you know, all kinds of things, ball games, plays with our kids.
Yep.
We're there at the hospital. We're giving up those things because we care enough to take care of people when they need us the most.
Well, if you get it from no one else, you get it from me. I appreciate the work you guys do. In my experience, nurses are just some of the greatest human beings on this planet, right up there with teachers, you know, people who take care of us all the time, and I appreciate it. I wish you guys nothing but the best, and as this moves forward, I hope you'll come back and tell us how this progresses, because we're on your side.
Well, thank you very much for your support. I think I can speak for the 800 RNs at UPMC Altoona. We appreciate you having us, and thank you for your support.
Thanks so much, Kim Heverly. I appreciate the time, and best of luck. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Boy, just when you think that Uber Rich couldn't get any more narcissistic or nutty, along comes Tom Perkins. He suddenly forced himself on us with a loud, self-pitying whine, which he let loose in a January letter to the Wall Street Journal. Perkins is a billionaire venture capital huckster who's not content to count his multitudinous blessings, but instead wants us to know how terribly difficult it is to be rich in America. "I perceive a rising tide of hatred of the successful 1%, he wailed. If he had stopped there, he would have revealed himself as just another ridiculous, old, and crotchety billionaire. They do seem to be a dime a dozen these days. But Perkins has no brakes on his peevishness, so he hurtled right into the swamp of extreme nuttiness, asserting that, quote, the progressive war on the American 1% is like Nazi Germany's war on its 1%, namely, its Jews. I thought, surely this guy is not real. Maybe he's a made-up character in one of Stephen Colbert's satirical skits. But no, Perkins ranted on, insisting that just as anti-Semitism led to the rounding up of Jews and the hellish Kristallnacht of 1938, today's, quote, demonization of the rich would lead to a similar horror for America's wealthy minority. Yeah, Tom, we see your point. Being a billionaire is as terrible as being subjected to the Holocaust. This is Jim Hightower saying, he has since offered a lame apology to, quote, any who have mistaken my reference. But still, he's consumed by a whimpering narcissism, moaning that everyone now hates me. I don't know if Perkins has any loved ones around him, but if not, he should rent one. Someone who will gently take away his writing implements and put him in a comfortable chair in a dark, quiet room so he can be alone with his thoughts and never bother us again with any of them. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for?
No, the sad thing is you hear that story. You hear those stories too often now, that you've got these big behemoths that we've allowed to grow up around us. We've allowed these big corporate special interests, these huge, and even nonprofits. I mean, the UPMC, as I understand, is a nonprofit hospital. Doesn't mean they're not making money hand over fist and paying out huge compensation to their CEOs, no, and their boards of directors and all of that. Trust me, there's plenty of money greasing the palms there. But when the workers say, hey, you know, we'd like to, you know, be able to retire at some point in our lives, that's a bridge too far. When we'd like to support our families, that's way off the path. And when they want to have some say in how many patients they have to care for, that's really way out of control. Getting too uppity, you workers. And I remember going back, you know, and I've been thinking about, you know, during the break, I was thinking about some of the situations that I've been in over the last, you know, 20 years. We moved here to Pennsylvania because my ex-wife's parents were terminally ill. And we ran in, and you know, it was constantly back and forth to hospitals and doctors and all of this. And I remember the extensive experience that I had with numerous hospitals in the Lehigh Valley and in Philadelphia. I remember it was the nurses who were the kindest, the gentlest, the most willing to take a moment and explain. And compassionate. These are people who say, you know, we know what you're going through and this is what to expect and this is how to make it easier. And these were just wonderful human beings. So I look at this situation where you've got this huge hospital chain coming in to a situation where they had had peace. They had had labor peace. They had gotten along. It was a situation, as she said, they had never gone to arbitration. Nothing. Things worked itself out and they moved forward for the patients. Now this is not about the patients. This is about the profit. This is about the money. And to me, this is why having these huge, huge hospital chains is not just destructive for working conditions, but destructive for health care. I look at this situation in this story that that someone sent me from Scott Kies over at Think Progress. Evidently, he interviewed a guy in Texas, a 49-year-old guy, Israel Hilton, who, you know, worked his entire life. Was a customer service rep at Kmart. In fact, he was employee of the year once. And, you know, by all accounts, an excellent employee. Because of their health care and because he didn't make an awful lot of money, couldn't afford health care, he didn't have it. And, you know, he said he did, you know, something. But he had some headaches, really severe headaches. Went to the emergency room, and they basically told him, you're depressed. turned into seizures. Well, it's depression. You know, go home, you'll be fine. And he said that once he went home, and they calmed for a bit, and then they came back with a vengeance. Turned out, 6 months later, he was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And, you know, as he points out, had he had insurance, maybe he would have sought a second opinion on the "you're just depressed" diagnosis. But last year, his income was $13,334. That is almost $10,000 more than the state of Texas allows for someone to get Medicaid. And I'm going, what? $3,000? That's all you can earn to be able to get Medicaid? Really? Who can possibly exist on $3,000? But you look at it, and I go back to what Keystone Progress wrote out about Governor Corbett. And while I don't agree with the headline, I think it's a pale just a little bit too far, but I understand it. I don't agree with it. I understand it. That because of Governor Corbett's inactivity, his unwillingness to accept the Medicaid expansion money, the four people are potentially going to die every day this year because they lack the care. Texas has the largest population of uninsured in the country. Texas, like Pennsylvania, is one of about a couple of dozen states that are not taking the Medicaid expansion money. So you got to start asking the question, okay, what happens to people who are working? And these are the low-wage workers that I've been talking about for some time. These are the people who are left out in the cold. These are the people who aren't going to get the preventative care. These are the people who are, when they do go to the emergency, when they finally break down and use the most expensive mode of health care possible, the emergency room, and they're given a quick diagnosis of, hey, you know, we ran this quick test, a follow-up with somebody else who's going to be much more expensive, but here's what we think it is, go home. Like in this guy's case, oh, you're just depressed. That's all. Go home and lay down. You'll be fine. 6 months later, he's got terminal brain cancer. Now, a private hospital in Texas has taken him on, and they've done some surgery, and they've done what they can. They've cut out as much as they could cut out, and they've done what they can. But, look, the reality is he's got about 18 months, according to the doctors there. And understand, you know, the private hospital that's doing this, he is getting the indigent care, but taxpayers are still paying for it. And this is the part that, you know, I had the conversation with my Tea Party dentist this morning on. We're already paying for the uninsured, but we're paying a lot more than we have to. A lot more. I mean, you know, what they're going to probably write off is pretty extensive, and what they're going to pass on to everybody else is pretty extensive as well. What's interesting is even if the brain cancer doesn't kill him, the care that he's getting is only for the brain cancer, not for the diabetes that he has. So he's not getting his testing strip. He's not getting his insulin. He's not getting the care for that and the follow-ups that go. So that's only going to get worse. And you know, as I was reading through this story, I'm remembering the guy that the last time we did the Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays was in July. Or no, that was the second year we did it. It was in July, and it was hot as a dickens. It was the worst week of my life, I got to be honest. I'll stay outside in the cold anytime. Heat in July on asphalt without taking a shower was one of the worst weeks of my life. But this guy, Joe, and I'll never forget him, he was homeless, and you know, he came and he sat with us and stayed with us for the whole week. Now, at the end of the week, you know, I said, you know, I appreciated, you know, you coming, staying with us. It was nice of you to share your stories. He goes, where else was I going to go? And the line he gave me, this is the safest I've felt in a year. Because living out on the streets, not a safe gig. But his story was one that sticks with me. He worked every day of his life, came from a fairly well-to-do family who had all passed on. Had a upper middle class upbringing, had you know good schools, good education, good everything, up until the parents passed on and the family passed on and all of that. And he was like one of the last of the generation. And then he got sick, had a job the whole time, got sick. I think he said he had a heart attack. Couldn't go back to the job, so after a certain amount of time, he was a veteran and all of that, all of this stuff right down the list. After a certain amount of time that he couldn't go back to the job, they cut him off the health care. So no more health care. And no more money coming in. He was able to get Medicaid to keep getting him health care through the taxpayer, but they couldn't get him any money so he could stay in his apartment. He ended up losing his apartment. And then he got sick again, back into the hospital. So in the interim, he loses everything. Lost everything. The landlord, evicts him, throws all of his stuff out into the street. This horrible story. He's got nowhere to go. He's homeless. Now understand, as a commonwealth, we spent a couple $100,000 on his heart attack and on a number of other ailments that he had. At the point where I met him, he was a very sickly man. But he was getting care and, there was a chance for him to survive longer. But he was homeless. And I remember going, it doesn't make any sense to me that on one hand, we're providing world-class care to this guy, sparing no expense, only to say, there's the street. It really, really makes no sense to me. Which is why I think as a matter of policy, as a matter of common sense, there's got to be some baseline to where nobody goes without care. No one goes without insurance. Because, like I told the hygienist guy today, if you don't have health care, we're not going to let you die on the street. We're going to, like Joe, we're going to take in, get you what you need to get fixed up. Now, you're not going to get preventative care. We're going to make sure you don't die at that moment, which, again, is going to be much more costly as we go on. But we're paying for that. So if we're already paying for it and paying a lot for it, shouldn't we be doing the other end of it first by making sure that you get preventative care? And, oh, by the way, maybe a place to sleep at night so that you don't get sicker? Just kind of a thought. And one that I hope at some point, we can answer. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I ain't never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents, you may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. In 2012, Fox repeatedly pushed the smear that Susan Rice, for political reasons, deceptively attributed the Benghazi attacks to violent protests over an anti-Islam video. Fox host Megyn Kelly even questioned whether Rice was qualified to serve as Secretary of State because of that. In 2014, she is singing a different tune. During her Fox News show, Kelly referenced a House committee report released that day, saying,
The CIA actually came out, I want to look at it here, and said, this is a draft from September 14th, 11:15 a.m., we believe, based on currently available information, that the attacks in Benghazi were spontaneously inspired by the protests at the embassy in Cairo and evolved into a direct assault. So tell me, does it or does it not answer the question about how our officials started to come out and talk about protests and the video?
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Minimum wage!
Yeah! You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Oh, yeah, not the truth. You listen to the fake news on Fox. You listen to
the corporate-controlled media. You listen to the people who make their living off of, we need the new McDonald's ad, please. We need to make sure that Walmart still advertises, or we're not going to be able to pay the millions out to our host. You look at that, and you go, it's no wonder that you've got these people out saying, well, we can't raise the minimum wage, too much money. You look at these people at fake news on Fox, and this Brian Kilmeade, who really, I think somebody needs to smack. He's one of those guys who just, you look at him, you go, there's a guy who just, as my grandfather would say, needs to be made a citizen out of. A good smack across the back of the head might do that. Or, you know, one of those guys who was an LMV as a kid, well, a lunch money victim. And now he's got a platform that he feels safe in. It's time to point the finger and pick at people. He goes on this rant today about the minimum wage. And, you know, how's it going to affect business? What's it going to do to business? And he goes on, you know, going, you know, if you want to get it, he says, elevate everybody's minimum wage to $10 from seven and something. You have to say to yourself, for those people who make $2 above the minimum wage, whatever it is, they're going to go, excuse me, can I have a raise? Because the whole country, can we have a raise? He goes on to say, then you got to ask yourself, every business owner, can you handle that? Will it affect hiring? So there's going to be a ripple effect, and the president's trying to show that he's not going to be hamstrung by the legislature, not going along. And, you know, the little flack on the side says, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, it's going to be bad for job creation. Job creation's bad. It's going to be bad. And it's just, you know, it's just bad. When the reality is we've known for years, the minimum wage does not affect unemployment. I mean, we've heard this canard over and over again. That, you know, hundreds of thousands of people will be out of jobs. And, you know, my favorite line, and I remember during the Clinton years, someone, when Clinton was pushing to raise the minimum wage, there was a woman that was on stage with him at some event. And I don't know why I remember this. I do, because it was a great line. The person asked her, do you fear that you're going to lose your minimum wage job? And she's like, no, I can always find a minimum wage job. I fear I'm not going to be able to eat. And I thought that was just for some reason that sticks into my head, because it's true. But they keep throwing this out there. Oh, it's going to harm the economy. It's going to kill the jobs. The job crisis is going to be bad. It's going to be down. When we know, I mean, the studies are already done. There's actually a stimulative effect. Because where Kilmeade is right is everybody's going to say, we'd like a little bit of it. And trust me, there's money out there to be had. If you look at the corporate profits, if you look at what Wall Street is sitting on, you look, and maybe at some point people start going, we need to have a reasonable, rational tax code. But we've been sold this right-wing economics for so long that, well, you know, it might just be cheaper to mechanize. You're going to do it anyway. Trust me, it's coming. It's going to happen. So all of this fear-mongering, all of these tactics are nothing more than putting off what we need to be doing. They say that something about 17 million people would be affected if you raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour. About 17 million workers. And you start to think about this, and you go, okay, well, what would happen? What would happen if you had 17 million more people with another couple hundred bucks in their pocket a month? What would they do? Would they be storing that money in their offshore Cayman account? Would they be vacationing in you know, the French Isle? Would they be on the Ivory Coast on their yacht? No, of course not. They're going to be spending money in their community. They're going to be buying new shoes for the kids. They're going to help the economy. So when I hear all of these voices and all of these talking heads on the right screaming about, oh, it's bad for business, we know that's not true. We know it's actually good for business. You know what would be really even better for business? And, you know, to go back to the healthcare thing, take that off their back. Because one of the biggest drivers in labor costs, healthcare. And, you know, the socialist president, the communist president, Obama, is actually trying to do that at a certain level. And yet, all we hear is, why he's bad for business. I look at the last couple of years, and you got to go, bad for business? How? Massive tax breaks. Whatever they want. We haven't seriously regulated anything for all of the cries of regulation and onerous taxation and all of this. I don't see it. And maybe it's because I lived in an era where we had higher tax rates and we had a little better regulatory oversight. Maybe it's because I was alive then and that I saw we weren't just standing around looking at each other. But that's kind of what they tell us, isn't it? You know, if, well, it's gonna, everything's going to come to a screeching halt. We'll just all be looking at each other. So I look at this and I go, you know, it's about time that Obama says something about it. It's about time Obama says something about the fact that we need a more progressive agenda, that we need to be looking towards extending unemployment benefits at least another 3 months, which can't seem to get done. The snowstorm got the debt ceiling raised, but no help for the unemployed who may end up out in the cold in the snowstorm. I don't see the political appetite on the federal level to extend and to raise the minimum wage. And then you get into some of the other stuff. You know, we should be pushing for paid sick time. We should be pushing for paid family medical leave. And a little later on in the program, we're going to talk to someone from the National Partnership for Women and Families about this new surveys out that says, hey, you know what? People actually do want a more progressive series of policies that help families, that help raise wages and give a safety net under people. People actually want that stuff. Really? Who would have ever thought of it? You know, if you listen to our politicians, you go, well, who could have ever thought that that's what they would have wanted? Who would have thought that American workers would want higher wages, that American workers would want to be able to take a sick day when they or their children are sick, or when who would ever thought that if a family member gets sick that they'd want to be able to care for them? Who would have ever thought that? Huh. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone, email rick@ricksmithshow.com. Quick back, right back after this with Hour 2. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Have you heard about the Great Chicago Pension Caper? The Chicago Teachers Union says it's happening as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel tries to negotiate with the union at the point of a gun. The Teachers Union says in the midst of these negotiations, Illinois State Senator John Cullerton is launching a salvo that could be the start of the Great Chicago Pension Caper. Cullerton is estimating future pension cuts for teachers. The Chicago Teachers Union says the city is threatening to lay off 3,000 teachers and raise student class sizes. The union vows to defend retirement security for educators in Chicago. The union says pensions are not gifts. They are earned through labor by workers who expect the money to be there as promised. The union says the pension problem in Illinois is a revenue problem, not an expenses problem. Chicago schools are making a budgeted pensions payment of $613 million to the pension fund by June 30th. But between 1995 and 2005, the Chicago district made no pension payments. Teachers and other municipal employees in Chicago are going to the Illinois State Capitol February 19th to, quote, encourage legislators not to raid their benefits while their wealthy corporate allies reap the financial benefits of their hard labor, end quote. Republican Tennessee U.S. Senator Bob Corker is urging VW workers in Chattanooga to vote against joining the UAW this week. Corker flip-flopped from his original public position, which was that the decision is in the hands of the workers and it would be inappropriate for him to comment until they vote. UAW Region 8 Director Gary Castile says it's sad that when workers exercise their legal right to form a union, Tennessee politicians like Corker threaten the economic well-being of communities and businesses just because workers want to have a voice in the future of Volkswagen in Chattanooga. Castile says it's unfortunate that Senator Corker has been swayed by special interests from outside of Tennessee to flip-flop on his position on what's best for Chattanooga's working families. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, are voting Wednesday through Friday on whether or not to have the UAW represent them, a vote that's expected to have a significant impact on union organizing at foreign-owned auto plants throughout the South.
Castile says the decision should be left to the workers. VW is neutral on the union vote and has urged third parties to stay out of it. But right-wing anti-union groups are waging a public campaign against the VW workers joining the UAW.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News is the only national daily radio newscast focused on workers and their unions to help keep those voices on the radio. Donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
A touch of honesty, if you will. A little bit of honesty from Congressman Zach Womp. Telling it the way it is. Look, the whole right-to-work argument, it's about less wages. It's about lower wages, less health care, no pension. That's what it's really about. It's not about this nonsense that we hear from the radical right across this country that somehow, we care about workers and we care about their paycheck and we're trying to protect their paychecks. They used to sell bridges. You never actually got them, but they used to sell them to you anyway. And I look at this senator from Tennessee, this Bob Corker, who released a statement today, which, it's one of these things, you go, really? Is this legal even? So the statement he writes, he says, I've had conversations today, and based on those, I'm assured that should the workers vote against the UAW, Volkswagen will announce in the coming weeks that it will manufacture its new mid-sized SUV here in Chattanooga. And what if the workers decide that they want to have that voice? As I've talked to folks on this program, does that mean that they're not going to? And is that what he's saying? Here to help answer that question, our good friend Stu Akoff. He is a former director of organizing with the National AFL-CIO, currently national organizing director with 1199. Stuart, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Rick. It's always great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this statement by Tennessee Senator Bob Corker. I see it as more than just a veiled threat. I see it as an outward threat.
No, it is. I've known Corker now since 2006 when he and Harold Ford ran against one another. And Corker's a Southern anti-worker, right-wing Republican. He used to be mayor of Chattanooga. He's stuck his nose in this ever since it began. Nobody's asked him to do it other than the Right to Work Foundation, but workers haven't asked him to stick his nose in it. The union hasn't asked him to, and certainly Volkswagen hasn't asked him to. The interesting thing here about both Corker and Womp, I think as it's said in Tennessee, and of course, as you know, I'm a Tennessee native, is that the UAW and Volkswagen released a joint statement asking outside parties to stay out of it. And now you got two politicians. And, let me just say that this is two politicians who are misrepresenting their own people. They want lower wages for their own people. They want a lower quality of life. They want fewer benefits. They don't want health care for their own people. And they don't want pensions for their own people. It's a very, very sad state of affairs of the right-wing Republican Party in America.
Well, I hope that the folks of Tennessee take notice of this, and that then you end up exercising your right to term limits and throw these bums out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I hope you're right, and I think there's a good chance people will. And Corker is not that popular across the state. He's as I said, he was mayor of the fourth largest city in Tennessee. He used racism to defeat Harold Ford Jr. in that Senate race.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember the Call Me Harold bimbo commercial? And so he's not that popular. And I think, you know, these right-wingers, they can sometimes get away with being right-wing on social issues. But when they come out so firmly against workers and in a way that really he's not representing anybody but the Right to Work Foundation and the Chamber of Commerce. He's certainly not representing the employer.
Yeah. Well, then that's an interesting part, Stuart. I mean, the employer, and this is rare in this country, that the employer is saying, you know what, if our workers want this, that's what they'll get. And I think that there's a push in corporate America to go, whoa, don't do that, because other people might expect us to do that.
Right. I think that's true. And of course, you know, Volkswagen is a German company, and let's remind your listeners, a lot of them know this, but let's remind them that in Germany, corporations are required to have government representatives and union representatives on their board of directors. It's one of the reasons that they are the most successful manufacturing country in the world. They maintain a high export over import ratio. They are known all over the world for their quality products, particularly their metalworking products, and they have a very powerful metal workers union.
Yeah.
And they were involved on the board with saying, you know, American workers should have the same rights as German workers. Now, who in America could disagree with that? American workers should have the same right as German workers.
No.
And does Bob Corker not think that American workers should have the same rights as German workers? Does Zach Womp not think American workers should have the same rights as German workers? I mean, that's the idiocy of this thing. And it's the idiocy of the right-wing Republican Party, particularly the southern part of it.
Yeah, we had talked to a worker about a month ago, and that's exactly what he said. He said they had some German workers come in, you know, to see how the plant is run, because they were actually on the board of the corporate board, which they do this sharing program, and it's really a very innovative idea and something that we don't have in this country, as you pointed out, without people on the different boards. And he hit on that exactly. He goes, you know, he knew nothing about unions, had never had any people in his family part of a union, but when the guy said, you should have at least what I've got and a voice where you work, he said it clicked in his head, and it made perfect sense when put to him in that frame.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the case for a lot of American workers, that when you begin to think about questions like benefits, like a pension versus a 401k, you know, you and I will retire with defined benefit pensions, which means that we both know, certainly I know, exactly what I'm going to get on retirement. Well, you know, most Americans don't have that anymore. That's now mostly a thing of the past. And we're the only industrialized country where you don't, where you're not certain you're going to make a livable income when you retire. And of course, the only industrialized country where health care is the kind of problem that it is now in this country. So, and it's also smart on the part of the German workers, because unlike us, they are making sure that their employer is not going somewhere else to underbid German workers.
Exactly. And what I found interesting is Chattanooga, Tennessee was the only place in the world where workers didn't have any voice, any organizing capability, any union, anywhere in the world with Volkswagen.
Right. No, and that's really a
And that's really the model for the future. I mean, isn't that the message for labor of the future, to be looking at and saying, okay, well, we're going to make sure that if Walmart is pushing a supply chain, who knows where, we're going to follow them and make sure that those workers have the same rights, the same voice, the same everywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's got to happen. That's what, you know, that the point you just made, Rick, is part of the key to the future of the world economy, the global economy, and workers all over the world, that we have to change. And America, really the whole world is looking at America on at least two different economic questions. One is making sure that in our trade policies we give as much consideration to workers' rights and environmental protections as we do to intellectual property rights or, you know, IMF payback.
We do that? Do we do that?
We don't do that.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, I don't think we've ever done that. I don't think we're talking about doing that now with the TPP.
No, we're not talking, and that's one of the reasons that the Congress should reject the TPP. I mean, but it is done. That's exactly how the European Union was created, to lift up the Spains and Portugals and not pull down the Germanys and Swedens and Denmarks. And I think the American people, I mean, this has only happened in the last 35 years, that workers in America now have a lower quality of life than workers all over the world, certainly a lower quality of life than workers in the rest of the industrialized world.
And I would argue that has everything to do with our neoliberal trade policies. Taking it back to Reagan and Bush with NAFTA and Clinton signing NAFTA and all of the WTO, GATT, all of that stuff. Right up till this idiocy, the secrecy of the TPP, which fast track authority, absolutely not under for anybody. I think it's a horrible idea, but especially now.
Right. No, that's exactly right. Especially when we have, you know, we are home to the one global corporation that's doing the most and pushing the hardest for the economic race to the bottom, and that's Walmart.
Yep.
And that's exactly what TPP is about. It's allowing Walmart and other giant retailers, you know, I'm going to mention the Gap because they were one of the ones who wouldn't sign on to the deal when those people,
in Bangladesh,
those women were burned up. 400-odd women were burned up in Bangladesh. And the Gap and other clothing, cheap clothing stores, and Walmart, who just want to exploit labor from China to Vietnam to Indonesia to Malaysia, just looking for the most exploited workers, the most vulnerable workers, to rip off. And so we have a responsibility in this country, and that is to demand that our trade policies reflect human rights. And, you know, the radical right is excellent at talking about defending human rights, except when it comes to real human beings and real rights, especially rights on the job.
Right. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Stuart Acuff. He is the National Organizing Director for 1199. You know, I look at this, Stuart, and, you know, to bring it back to Pennsylvania, now the Koch brothers have their ALEC-based piece of legislation banging around our General Assembly. I'm talking about 1507 and the House and Senate Bill 1034, which I encourage everyone to call your representatives and say no, absolutely not on 1507 and 1034. But I look at this ALEC piece of legislation that's been imported into our Commonwealth, and, you know, I look at this as, you know, nobody's calling for this under the guise of we're going to somehow protect people's paychecks. And I love the rhetoric of the right. We're going to give you paycheck protection with no protections. Because I've asked people, does it protect me It's wage theft, hour theft. Does it protect me from you stealing my pension? Any of that? Well, no. What is it protecting me from?
All right. It's protecting you from yourself.
Is that what it is?
Protecting you from authorizing the payment of dues or dues deductions. Look, there's two things about this. You know, one is, and I know this for a fact, and as they said when people like me were growing up, you can look it up. The sanitation strike in Memphis that Dr. King was helping to lead when he was assassinated.
That started yesterday.
It started yesterday
back in 68.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. The workers were striking for two things: union recognition and the right to bargain a contract, and dues deduction, because they knew how hard it would be to hold their union together without automatic dues deduction. And so this is simply, there in the past, the Supreme Court had ruled that if you allow dues deduction for anything, the Red Cross, the United Way, or anything else, you have to allow it for unions as well. They had said that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But now we've got the radical right has figured out a way they can break the political back of the labor movement, and that's by essentially outlawing or making it impossible to run a public sector union. And the big picture here is, you know as well as I do, if not better, that the two states that generally determine who's president of the United States are Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Yep.
So if you can steal Pennsylvania, like you stole Florida in 2000, you stole Ohio in 2004 with all those irregularities, if you can steal Pennsylvania, you've got a better than even shot of stealing the presidency. And we know, I learned this a long time ago in the labor movement. What does the boss do when he can't win an election? He tries to steal it.
Yep.
And that's exactly what they've been doing now. 2016 will make 16 years. They've been trying to steal national elections. And that's all this is. I mean, you've got the most unpopular governor in the world in Tom Corbett, not going to get reelected, knows he's not going to get reelected. He's not coming out for this thing. He's afraid of it. You do not have unanimity. In fact, you have Republicans running from this thing. This was imported by the Koch brothers specifically to steal a presidential election. And that's what they intend to do.
Let me ask you last line of questioning then, because, you know,
sure.
I look at this maybe a little bit differently then. I look at 1507 and 1034, this ALEC piece of legislation that they euphemistically call paycheck protection. I see this as something that's finally poked awake the labor movement in this state that really has been fairly dormant for years. I see it as finally getting those workers who, you know, they were union members, but they were just doing their job, you know, living their life on the treadmill. And now I think you've poked people in the side and said, what, me? Coming after me? Going after us? Well, I never expected. I don't know if you saw the rally they had a couple of weeks ago on a Tuesday where thousands of people in the Capitol.
I was there. That's the last time I saw you.
Exactly.
It was wonderful. Thousands of people. They had three rallies at the same time. They had one in the main rotunda, one downstairs, and one outside. I got locked out.
Yeah, but I think they've awakened people, and I think this idea of you know, we're going to try and steal the election now, I think you finally awakened some minds that all of this right-wing insanity is here. Pretty much what I said 3 years ago, almost to the day, sleeping on the Capitol floor in Wisconsin as Governor Walker was doing the exact same thing that they're talking about doing right now in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's the exact same thing. It's what John Kasich did in Ohio, and he got his butt kicked for it because they put it on the ballot and beat him 68-32%. The people don't like this destruction of any possibility of having a voice on the job. And frankly, you know, as much as they attack public employees, public employees put our fires out. They pull us out of cars when we've wrecked cars. They keep us safe.
They're the people who are going to plow the roads tonight when the snow falls.
They're the people who are going to plow they're going to work a 24-hour shift starting tonight when it starts snowing. They'll, you know, get a call from the boss. It started to snow. They'll get out of bed. You know, they'll fill up a thermos with coffee and put their Carhartt overhauls on and go get in a dump truck with a snow plow in front of it, and they'll plow for 24 hours straight. And some people will only have to do it 12 hours, but they'll all be on at least 12-hour shift until the roads and streets of Pennsylvania are clear. And you're exactly right. I was at it's interesting. Philadelphia 1199 had our shop stewards meeting tonight. We call it the delegates meeting. And, you know, people were there, hospital workers were there, and they were grumbling but willing to do so, going back on the job before the snow started. And knowing that some of them would spend the rest of the night in a hospital and spend tomorrow night in a hospital, likely sleeping on the floor. And a lot of them were public employees, Temple Hospital, public facility. And, you know, the same can be said of Pittsburgh. You know, my mother was a school teacher, Rick, and as much as the radical right has tried to turn us against teachers, they're the people who taught us how to read.
Yep.
They're the people who prepared us for the work world.
They taught us. They're the ones who taught us to read the misspelled sign that the Workers for Freedom or whatever the euphemistic group put up in Tennessee to tell the workers that Obama, UAW funds Obama.
They taught us how to spell potatoes or potato.
There's no E there? Come on, Stuart. No, that's going way back. For folks who don't remember, that's the quailism before they put him back in the box.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. That's funny to remember that because I would have sworn it was George Bush, but you're right. It was Darren Quayle. He corrected a kid who spelled potato correctly on the blackboard, and the vice president of the United States did not know how to spell potato.
No, it's been years since he's had to do that. Just like, you know, when Bush went to the supermarket and didn't know what a scanner was. Yeah, you know, it's years before they know anything. And this is what gets me. We've got these politicians who push these laws who have no idea what it's like to be an average everyday working stiff like you or me or our listeners. They have no idea. There's a total disconnect. And what gets me is you talk to these folks who basically won a popularity contest, who aren't smart enough to spell potato. And they're the ones who are taking all of this campaign cash handed to them by the likes of the Koch brothers and their ilk, the Sheldon Adelsons and the rest of them, not really even cognizant of how it's going to affect average, everyday working people. And to me, that's what's infuriating.
That is infuriating. They're not cognizant. But beyond that, they don't care. They simply don't care how we live. And there's no other way of explaining it. I mean, but you and I both know and I'll say it, the Koch brothers are extorting politicians in Harrisburg, and they're bribing politicians. They're telling them, if you support this legislation, we'll give you all the money you need to win. If you don't, we'll fund your opponent in a primary. I mean, that's, it may be legal, but it's extortion, and bribery. And, that's what they're doing. Koch brothers have no interest in Pennsylvania, what's good for the state, what's good for the people of the state. And besides the fact that the Koch brothers are leading the crowd who thinks the best way to run the economy is to starve working people who actually drive the economy if given half a chance.
Yeah.
Which is hurting all of them. The declining wages, the minimum wage that declines every month as cost of living goes up, the lack of pay raises, the lack of retirement security, the fact that people are having to work until they're 70 years old or 75, or can't retire ever. You tell me a cop in Detroit will ever be able to retire. He won't. You know why? Or she won't. You know why?
Because they just stole his pension.
They stole his pension, and because they were public employees, they may not have paid into Social Security, because a lot of public employers don't. And so that cop, that firefighter, that snowplow driver in Detroit is got to work till he or she dies or move in with a it's like pre-1935.
Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished,
Mission
Stuart.
Mission accomplished, right.
We can break out the banner. You can get the sock for the drawers.
Yeah.
You can do all that stuff.
They rolled back the legislation 80 years prior to Franklin Roosevelt.
Wow. Absolutely insane. Stuart, I appreciate you taking time with us, buddy. I got to take a quick break here. Will you come back and talk to us again?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you want me to.
Oh, I will hold you that, because there's a lot going on here in the state, and I understand you're back in Pennsylvania banging around now, so
yeah.
I'm looking forward to more conversations with you, Stuart.
That'd be great. Appreciate you a lot, Rick.
I appreciate the time, buddy. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
America. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com. And search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Boy, just when you think that Uber Rich couldn't get any more narcissistic or nutty, along comes Tom Perkins. He suddenly forced himself on us with a loud, self-pitying whine, which he let loose in a January letter to the Wall Street Journal. Perkins is a billionaire venture capital huckster who's not content to count his multitudinous blessings, but instead wants us to know how terribly difficult it is to be rich in America. "I perceive a rising tide of hatred of the successful 1%, he wailed. If he had stopped there, he would have revealed himself as just another ridiculous, old, and crotchety billionaire. They do seem to be a dime a dozen these days. But Perkins has no brakes on his peevishness, so he hurtled right into the swamp of extreme nuttiness, asserting that, quote, the progressive war on the American 1% is like Nazi Germany's war on its 1%, namely its Jews. I thought, surely this guy is not real.
Maybe he's a made-up character in one of Stephen Colbert's satirical skits. But no, Perkins ranted on, insisting that just as anti-Semitism led to the rounding up of Jews and the hellish Kristallnacht of 1938, today's, quote, demonization of the rich would lead to a similar horror for America's wealthy minority. Yeah, Tom, we see your point. Being a billionaire is as terrible as being subjected to the Holocaust. This is Jim Hightower saying, he has since offered a lame apology to, quote, any who have mistaken my reference. But still, he's consumed by a whimpering narcissism, moaning that everyone now hates me. I don't know if Perkins has any loved ones around him, but if not, he should rent one. Someone who will gently take away his writing implements and put him in a comfortable chair in a dark, quiet room so he can be alone with his thoughts and never bother us again with any of them.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So a new survey out put forth by the folks at the American Women and the National Partnership for Women and Families, along with the Rockefeller Family Fund, have come up with some interesting and not all that surprising conclusions, which is why we've asked Vicki Shavo to come talk to us. She is the director of the National Partnership for Women and Families. Vicki, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
You know, I look at this report, and really none of the things that you've found out or uncovered or unearthed, I think, are all that surprising. I think most average, everyday working families, they want to see a raise in the minimum wage. They want to see things that are pro-family.
That's exactly right. None of this is surprising. And the reason it's not surprising is that each and every one of us every day are struggling with how we're going to pay our bills, how we're going to take care of our families and be responsible good workers on our jobs and advance in our careers. And what this poll shows is broad support across gender, across region, across class, and across race for more family-friendly policies, better wage policies, fair wages, less pay discrimination for men and for women, access to paid family and medical leave, access to paid sick days. These are all tremendously important policies that workers need. And more than that, they are policies that people believe will strengthen the U.S. economy and strengthen families' economic security.
You know, but the thing is I look at that one of the things you've unearthed, this idea that workers should have some ability to have paid sick time. One way or another, if they get sick, they can stay home and get well, or maybe even take care of a family member at some point. I look here in Pennsylvania, we've got a representative, Seth Grove, who's put forth a piece of legislation that would make it illegal for local municipalities, for cities, townships, boroughs, any political subdivision here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to extend these protections to any workers within their borders would make it absolutely illegal. And, you know, it's not Pennsylvania. There are a number of areas who have tried to do this as well. So it seems to me that there's a political difference here in ideology, one that's saying, hey, you know, we want to help, and one that says you're on your own.
Well, it would be different if Representative Grove's legislation were actually extending proactively a paid sick day standard that guaranteed all workers in Pennsylvania the right to take a sick day for themselves or to care for a loved one. But you're right. His legislation, like several other pieces of legislation around the country, are restricting the right of municipalities to set those kinds of common sense standards and, in fact, doesn't go further to create a standard for the state of Pennsylvania.
No, I look at
and we know that 40% of workers in Pennsylvania don't have a single paid sick day. That's
right.
Real money. That's the difference between putting food on the table and not, and having your family go hungry. It's the difference between paying rent and not. So this is real dollars and cents for people.
And the way I look at it is, it's, you know, you want to talk about real family values. How about giving people the ability to, maybe take care of their family?
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, that was the reason that there was bipartisan support for the Unpaid Family and Medical Leave Act back in 1993. Really prominent Republicans like Henry Hyde, who was a very popular and powerful member of Congress at the time, was one of the Republicans who stepped forward to support the FMLA. we're really lacking that sort of bipartisanship today in Congress and in state legislatures, and yet among the public, you know, this research and all of the research out there shows that these are popular issues, and these are policies that voters across party lines really want.
You know, it's interesting that you say that the public wants it, because, you know, I've been paying attention to the mainstream media, fake news on Fox and the such. And, you know, raising the minimum wage to them is what's the end of civilization. If we raise the minimum wage, no one will ever hire another worker again. If we give folks the ability to have an earned paid day off, be it sick day or vacation or whatever, it's the end of civilization. It's what I'm being told, but the reality is economically, that doesn't seem to hold up to scrutiny.
That's right. And in fact, the president of the Chamber of Commerce in San Francisco just recently said that the impact of the paid sick days law there, which was the first in the nation, that the impact of that law was minimal, that employers don't have problems, and that the economy is booming. So we hear these sort of sky is going to fall predictions, and yet all of the economic evidence that's out there shows, you know, quite definitively that these policies help the economy. They don't cost jobs. And on sick days as well, all of the growing evidence from San Francisco, from the District of Columbia, from the city of Seattle, from the state of Connecticut, show that these predictions of doom and gloom are completely wrong in reality.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, we there is a political party, and I know you're nonpartisan, that's your position, but there is a political party who continues to tell us that they believe in family values. That they're the party of family values, of true family values, and to them, true value family values are making sure that same-sex couples can't marry. That seems to be the extent of their family values. But to me, there's nothing more that says family values than being able to put food on the table, being able to keep a roof over the family's head, and when they're sick, to be able to take care of them. So, you know, it's not surprising that the numbers are on the side of moving in that direction.
Right. I couldn't agree more. I mean, what's more a value about family than being there if your child falls off the jungle gym and needs to be picked up from school, or if you need to take your mother to the doctor to get her heart checked? You can't really imagine something that's more about caring for family than that. And yet, without policies in place, without paid sick days policies, without paid family and medical leave for longer term or more serious issues, people are being forced to make impossible choices between keeping and advancing on their jobs and caring for their loved ones, and that being able to put food on the table.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up falling off the jungle gym. My oldest daughter, you know, a couple of years back when she was a little younger, fell off the parallel bars and broke her arm. And I got to be honest, I can't imagine what it would have been like knowing that, oh, my gosh, beyond the guilt that I got from, why'd you take me to the park, if I couldn't afford to pay for it, if I didn't have insurance to make sure that she got the, if I had to worry about that as well, and then had it happened in school, not being able to leave the job to go, I can't imagine what that is like.
That's exactly right, and yet people across the country are facing these challenges each and every day. A couple of years ago, I talked with a woman in Atlanta who had this issue where she was a restaurant server, and she got a call that her child literally had fallen off the jungle gym and she needed to go to the hospital. His arm was being set because he had broken it, and she was told that if she left, she wouldn't be able to come back.
So now what do you say to the people who, you know, and on the paid family leave, because I've fortunately throughout my life have used family medical leave a couple of times. When each of the children were born, I was able to spend the first 7-8 weeks at home with them, which I think every father should have, every parent should have the opportunity to do. And I think as a matter of law, we should be almost mandating it, because I think it's that important. But I don't know many people who can afford to take those 7, 8, 12 weeks off without pay, which is why it's always been curious to me why we couldn't come up with some type of a fund, just like unemployment compensation, to say, you know, while you're taking this time, maybe you collect unemployment, maybe you get something to, A, encourage people to do it as a matter of policy in society, but also as a matter of policy economically.
That's exactly right, and that's why there's a new proposal pending in Congress, the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or the Family Act, which was introduced late last year, December 12th of 2013, by Senator Gillibrand in the Senate and Senator DeLauro in the House. It's a proposal that's gaining support in Congress. It's a proposal that's supported by more than 430 organizations in all 50 states and by a growing number of businesses, because increasingly, you know, there is this recognition that people need to be able to take the time that they need when a new baby arrives, or a child is ill, or a parent is ill, or a spouse, or when a worker themselves experiences a serious illness, and that it makes sense for everybody, for that worker, for their family, for their employer, and for the community and the economy, for them to be able to take that time with some wage replacement and then come back to work. The proposal that I just talked about is funded just like similar to unemployment, where there is a fund that is created. Employees and employers would each pay in an average of $1.50 a week. And in return, when a worker needs to take the time off to care for themselves or their loved ones, they get up to 66% of their wages for middle class and working class workers.
So basically what you're saying is the employers are going to, it's going to be such an onerous expense on the employers that's never going to work. $1.50 a week, no one can afford that.
Well, some people will say it's a slippery slope. I would say it's just common sense and good business decisions.
In the rest of the industrialized world, and I know here in this country, we like to puff up our chest and say, we're number one, we're the best, we're the greatest, look at us. In the rest of the world.
In fact, we're the number one industrialized country that does not offer paid maternity leave to new mothers, and one of a handful that doesn't offer sick leave, extended sick leave. So in this way, we are far behind the rest of the world, and it's really shocking.
It is shocking, which is the reason I bring it up. I mean, there are so many things that we should be doing, in my view, as just a matter of course. That, you know, if you want to talk about family values, you want to talk about being the greatest country in the world. And the other frame that I always love is, and I don't want to get into a whole religious debate, but that we're this grand Christian nation. It would seem to me if any of those frames were accurate, these are the minimums.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly right. I mean, this is one way in which we really need to modernize our public policies to reflect the needs that working families have. And the reality that all parents in most families are in the workforce or a single parent. Is supporting a family, and often that's a woman. Women are, you know, half of the workforce. They are 40% of primary breadwinners and 2/3 of co-breadwinners in households. And that means that both women and men need to be able to take the time that they need with some wage replacement and then go back to work more productive, more loyal, and able to succeed in advance on the job, which creates more retirement security for them in the long run. It creates less burden on our public assistance program, and it creates stronger, healthier families.
Yeah, and if that's the goal is to have a stable community and stable families, I think this is the beginning of a step forward. Let me ask you about the policy you were just talking about, the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act. This is, because you know, I know some people are hell-bent on, well, you better be working, or we're not going to give you your earned income tax credit is based on if you have a job or not. Is this based solely on someone who's currently working, or unemployed? Could unemployed people be part of this? Because I consider working people, everybody who's looking for work and working, how is it worded today?
Right. So this would apply to anybody who has paid into the fund. So basically anybody who is eligible for Social Security disability insurance, which essentially means you have to have earned a certain amount of money over the last X quarters or number of years. And then you have to have received some wages from work in the last 12 months.
So how do we get this stuff passed through? I mean, you know, I look at the mainstream media. I look at the political dynamics, not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country and in Washington. And I don't know that I see yet the political will. I see a lot of people, a lot of friends, a lot of neighbors, a lot of family. People are saying, you know, we need these kind of safety net programs. They've been under assault for too long. What's it going to take if the political will's not there?
Well, I think we're in a moment where the political will is growing. So you saw the president talk very forcefully about fair pay, about paid sick days, about paid family leave in his State of the Union. And that paragraph garnered literally off-the-chart responses from voters and dial groups in a couple of places across the country. Overwhelming response to that. I've just actually been out here in California at a conference filled with really high-profile business executive celebrities, political figures, filmmakers, and others, all of whom are just excited for the changes that we all need. So I do think that we are in a moment, and it is the responsibility, you know, folks who are leaders and also just regular old voters who need to take action, contact their members of Congress, tell them that it's time for a change, and start to hold elected officials accountable for their action or lack of action on these policies.
So there are business leaders that are calling for this. I mean, I've seen a couple of outliers. You know, like last night we talked about these smart capitalists for American prosperity, which okay, hedge fund managers saying we should raise the minimum wage. I would like to say, hey, how about giving workers the right to collective bargaining? Let's make sure we get people back into unions and negotiating for better wages, hours, and conditions. Is there a push by business? Because it's my view that especially the bigger corporations, the big box retailers, the fast food industry, their goal is to suppress all this stuff and maybe even to push it off on government to subsidize.
Well, I think that there is definitely some truth to that, but I think that there are a growing number of business leaders who are willing to step out and say this isn't right, and it's not good business sense, it's not good for the economy. So, for example, Tom Knives, who's the vice chairman at Morgan Stanley, spoke at the press conference where Senator Gillibrand and Representative DeLauro introduced the Family Act and spoke about the need for the Family Act and for a national paid leave policy. Similarly, a woman named Onette Bonilla, who works for an environmental sciences company that has offices in many states, many employees, stood up and said at that press conference, too, and said this is something that makes sense. It's good business. And, in fact, her company has a whole webpage dedicated to her appearance at that press conference. The times are changing. There is a website called Better Businesses, Better Worksites, Better Businesses that's got a listing of and testimonials from businesses that are supportive. So there's a lot of work to be done. We've got some great champions in organizations like the American Sustainable Business Council, the Main Street Alliance, and Small Business Majority, and just a growing number of business folks and entrepreneurs who are saying this is good sense, and we as a country need to take this next step.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that, when consumers have money in their pockets, when families have a disposable income, it can be nothing but good for business. Last thing, give me an action. What do I do tomorrow morning? What do I do a week from now? What are the marching orders?
Well, right now you can go to www.nationalpartnership.org/action. And there you can send a note to your member of Congress on all of these policies, particularly on the Family Act, on the Paid Sick Days Bill, the Healthy Families Act, and on the Paycheck Fairness Act, as well as on another proposal that we haven't talked about, which is called the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act, which prevents employers from retaliating against workers who need reasonable accommodations on the job when they're pregnant, similar to the other kinds of accommodations with short-term physical limitations.
Yeah, I honestly can't even believe that that's even something that we would have to legislate, to be honest. It's outside of my ability to comprehend why that would be something that we would even have to attempt to legislate. It would just be, are you kidding me? We're going to make accommodations because this is the future of our country here.
Right. No, it makes total sense. And some people believe that current law, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act and the ADA, should already cover pregnant workers, and yet courts have applied those laws narrowly. And so this proposal, the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act, would simply ensure that pregnant women receive the same kinds of accommodations or are entitled to the same kinds of accommodations as other temporarily disabled folks. So the ability to take more frequent bathroom breaks, the ability to sit instead of stand when checking out customers, the ability to carry a water bottle. These simple things, which keep women employed through their pregnancies, make them eligible for things like the unpaid leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act, and ensure that they're able to keep their jobs at a time when they need income the most so that they're getting ready for a new baby. So common sense policies, but yeah, www.nationalpartnership.org/action. And that is one simple thing everybody can do right now to send notes to their members of Congress.
And we will make sure we get that link to therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Vicki Shavo's name. It'll take you right there. Vicki, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really great talking with you. Look, again, nationalpartnership.org/action. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Vicki's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, from the talk.
Just rest and call it. come together. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. In 2012, Fox repeatedly pushed the smear that Susan Rice, for political reasons, deceptively attributed the Benghazi attacks to violent protests over an anti-Islam video. Fox host Megyn Kelly even questioned whether Rice was qualified to serve as Secretary of State because of that. In 2014, she is singing a different tune. During her Fox News show, Kelly referenced a House committee report released that day, saying,
The CIA actually came out, I want to look at it here, and said, this is a draft from September 14th, 11:15 a.m., we believe, based on currently available information, that the attacks in Benghazi were spontaneously inspired by the protests at the embassy in Cairo and evolved into a direct assault. So tell me, does it or does it not answer the question about how our officials started to come out and talk about protests and the video?
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. And there you can click on Vicky Shavo's name. It'll take you right to her website where you can take action. And I think out of all of this, that's what it's going to take on every front. No matter what it is we're talking about, it takes people being active. It takes actually, well, caring. And, you know, I've had these conversations over and over throughout the years of people saying, you know, I care, but I'm just busy. And look, I understand it. But it's, you know, it's in your everyday lives, talking to friends and neighbors. What the right wing of this country has done masterfully, really, what they've done masterfully is they've repeated the story over and over again. And look, what they repeat is simple. It's all of the negative stuff. And I think if I had to live in that negative world, I would probably just rip my eyes out, because you have no idea how many emails I get from people that say, well, you know, I saw this and, you know, that those people, and it's always somebody else, which I kind of love. It's always that guy got something I didn't. It's like grade school all over again. Sometimes I often think that's, you know, it's there was a song I heard a couple of years, you know, it's a couple of years ago. It was it's just like high school. It's high school all over again. You know, and I just want my money back. But it's gonna take act people in the streets. It's gonna take what my grandparents' generation did. And I look at what's going on in Tennessee as the first start of this. I think what's going on in Tennessee is exciting. I think it's an opportunity for workers in the South to say, you know, we've been exploited for so long, and underpaid for so long, and the Zach Wamps of the world, they're right. It's about less pay. It's about less health care. It's about no pension. And I guess you got to ask yourself, are you okay with that? For the here and now, yeah, I guess it's okay. But, you know, I don't know that we're all going to be, you know, 18. We're all going to not be 30. At some point, you got to look towards the end of the road and go, you know, take the long view of things. You know, I have friends who say, well, I've got a 401k. I go, how much money are you going to do? Well, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Don't you get a statement? Well, yeah, but, you know, I haven't put anything into a while. Why not? I'm struggling to pay the bills. So this is the alternative that they gave us, the defined benefit pensions. And it's like everything else. The shifting of responsibility onto those who are unable to shoulder the burden. And I know that doesn't play into the hooray for me and the hyper-individual frame. It just doesn't. But reality is what it is. I look at my grandparents, who did everything that they could do within their power and did the right things. You know, my grandfather had an eighth grade education. My grandmother actually finished high school. And they worked every day of their lives. They saved. They bought a house. They lived the American dream.
They took vacations, you know, nothing extravagant. You know, your basic, you know, weekend here, weekend there. They didn't want for anything. They, you know, they got what they needed and some things that they wanted. And they were able to go into retirement going, okay, well, this is what we've got. We've got our savings. We've got our pensions from the jobs that we worked where the unions negotiated for a pension for us. So we've got that. We've got Social Security. We're going to be okay. My grandmother is okay. I start to think about my parents' generation. Now, my mother passed away years ago, but, you know, her generation, who around the, you know, the early 80s got shuffled off of the defined benefit plan into these 401ks, which was really an accounting trick to be able to shelter money for very rich people. And then they said, well, hey, we can shuffle people onto this and give them the illusion that they're going to be one of us. And that, I think, is really what it is. When I started working at the company I spent almost, you know, almost 20 years at, they said, you know, in 30 years, you're going to have $1 million. And I remember back in 1993 when I started there, I remember saying, there's no way they're going to allow a dumb truck driver to have $1 million. It's not going to happen. And after 18 years, I was there a little over 18, almost 19, after that period, I had about, I don't know, I think it was like 175. And I remember going, am I going to have the last 10, 12 years? Well, that is that what everything's going to really ramp up? And the answer is no. In fact, then the Great Recession hit, and bang, there the rest of it went, and I'm still digging out of it. So we've been sold this false bill of goods. And I got to be honest, there's part of me that goes, when are we going to get angry about it? Why are we going to be angry about the fact that we got ripped off? And in a huge way. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. We don't seem to be holding the bankers to account. We're not locking them up in large numbers. And why not? Why aren't we going after these people? Does it make sense to you on any real level? I mean, for me, it's, well, you know, something we should be doing. Something I'd like to see done. Anyway, it just is what it is. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Have you heard about the Great Chicago Pension Caper? The Chicago Teachers Union says it's happening as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel tries to negotiate with the union at the point of a gun. The Teachers Union says in the midst of these negotiations, Illinois State Senator John Cullerton is launching a salvo that could be the start of the Great Chicago Pension Caper. Cullerton is estimating future pension cuts for teachers. The Chicago Teachers Union says the city is threatening to lay off 3,000 teachers and raise student class sizes. The union vows to defend retirement security for educators in Chicago. The union says pensions are not gifts. They are earned through labor by workers who expect the money to be there as promised. The union says the pension problem in Illinois is a revenue problem, not an expenses problem. Chicago schools are making a budgeted pensions payment of $613 million to the pension fund by June 30th. But between 1995 and 2005, the Chicago district made no pension payments. Teachers and other municipal employees in Chicago are going to the Illinois State Capitol February 19th to, quote, encourage legislators not to raid their benefits while their wealthy corporate allies reap the financial benefits of their hard labor, end quote. Republican Tennessee U.S. Senator Bob Corker is urging VW workers in Chattanooga to vote against joining the UAW this week. Corker flip-flopped from his original public position, which was that the decision is in the hands of the workers, and it would be inappropriate for him to comment until they vote. UAW Region 8 Director Gary Castile says it's sad
that when workers exercise their legal right to form a union, Tennessee politicians like Corker threaten the economic well-being of communities and businesses just because workers want to have a voice in the future of Volkswagen in Chattanooga. Castile says it's unfortunate that Senator Corker has been swayed by special interests from outside of Tennessee to flip-flop on his position on what's best for Chattanooga's working families. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, are voting Wednesday through Friday on whether or not to have UAW represent them, a vote that's expected to have a significant impact on union organizing at foreign-owned auto plants throughout the South. Castile says the decision should be left to the workers. VW is neutral on the union vote and has urged third parties to stay out of it. But right-wing anti-union groups are waging a public campaign against the VW workers joining the UAW.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News is the only national daily radio newscast focused on workers and their unions to help keep those voices on the radio. Donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You know, I honestly believe everyone in our body is never going to use insider trading to advantage themselves over the best interest of the country.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out this on the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the big story today, you know, and I got to be honest, I wasn't overly surprised. I don't think anybody really was. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. You may remember the name Ray Nagin after the Hurricane Katrina hit and New Orleans was just basically a soup bowl of toxic mess. He was the guy out there from the beginning saying, hey, you need to be doing more. He was the face of it. And I remember saying at the time, you know, they're going to dig into this guy and they're going to find skeletons because he's got to be destroyed because he's made the Bush administration look bad. And he did. And to his credit, he did. He was out there saying, hey, you know, there's destruction, there's death, there's turmoil, there's chaos. We need the assistance. We need it now. And, you know, gave the administration at the time, if you remember back in 2005, gave him a black eye. Now, we had gone a year afterwards, and I remember looking around as if things had just happened. I mean, it looked like virtually nothing had gone on, and we had spent some time for the next couple of years looking at a lot of the graft, a lot of the wasted resource. And really, this is what happens, in my view, when you have all of these private companies vying for these account for this money, this pot of gold. And that's really what it is. It's this pot of gold that now, hey, disaster capitalism. We've now created an environment where, hey, you know, things are horrible. We've got to do something. So there's all this money out there. And, well, if you didn't hear, Ray Nagin, the former mayor of New Orleans, was convicted today on 20 of 21 charges of corruption. For basically, you know, taking the money and taking bribes. And, you know, a couple of the stories came down that, you know, his son owned a granite business, granite for countertops, and for a certain amount of favors, you know, got this kid a bunch of work. And, you know, just the stories of, you know, trips and the stories of money. In fact, the prosecutors used 26 different witnesses. And, you know, stacks and stacks of documents to go through how Nagin got about $500,000 in payouts. Got trips to Jamaica, New York, you know, all kinds of stuff in exchange for these contracts. And, you know, as I was reading through it this afternoon, you think about it, you go, you know, okay, you've got these salespeople. And for anybody who's been, you know, wined and dined by salespeople or by lobbyists or any of these folks, they're really, really smooth. And I don't know. There's part of me that looks at this and goes, you know, how much of this was he got sucked into a situation where he had to make decisions on who was going to do what, and the money was in his control, and he was the guy at the top. And, you know, that's where the, you know, that's where they send the women and the wine, man. They're going to loosen you up. They're going to get your, they're going to get your secrets, and then they're going to extort you over it. So, you know, I look at this and I go, yeah, here's a guy, you know, a great story gone really bad. Someone who at the time was seen as incorruptible or uncorruptible, or and somebody who was fighting for the little guy. And now they've pinned this, and look, it's stuck, and it's sadly, it's probably true. And, you know, I've talked to people who, you know, they've been around the political process a while. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to fall into these traps, into these schemes that, well, you know, I look at the McDonald's in Virginia. You know, another example of this, you know, I wasn't a fan of McDonald's policies, the former governor, but, you know, when you have to start looking at accepting bribes and this stuff to be able to maintain your lifestyle because you've made bad decisions, kind of makes you wonder, should you be in office? But it's sad. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I go back to our time when we were in New Orleans. And, you know, the stories that you heard, like, for instance, you know, there was a company that was hired to move the trash. Because, you know, they were basically chucking stuff into the middle of the street, and trucks would come by, and back, or, you know, front-end loaders and trucks would come by to scoop this stuff and take it away. As I remember, the guy told me, he said, you know, when they moved the trash away, they paid a company, we, the taxpayers, paid $47 a ton to move the trash out. And you're talking a lot of weight, you know, massive amount of debris. And the guy who... I was talking to you, said, you know, at the end of it, when they had subcontracted, and you think of all of this graft and all of this corruption and all the palm greasing, which, you know, makes people really angry at their government. But understand, this is how the gig works sometimes. So we gave the contract to one company. And this is how it was explained to me. We gave it to Company A, who Company A didn't have the capability of actually doing the work. So they had to subcontract it out to Company B. So Company A got $47 a ton. They subcontracted it out to Company B and C, say, for $45 a ton. Keeping, we'll be generous and say they only kept $2. Probably it was closer to $5. Who then subcontracted it out to D and E and F and for like $30. And then by the time you actually got to the guy down at the bottom who did the work, the person whose feet were on the ground, whose truck was rolling through the streets, who was actually hauling the stuff away and doing the hard work, it was about $5 a ton. So you're talking about somewhere around the neighborhood of $42 a ton of the 47 going to greasing palms and to enriching bottom lines. That, my friends, that's crony capitalism. That's what disaster capitalism brings us. And it's exactly what happened here. And you go and you look at this and you go, how much of that money ended up into the coffers of campaigns? How much of that money ended up in, and you know, go trips to here and there, which is why I've always been an advocate of complete and openness. And sunshine disinfects an awful lot of things. And making it to where, you know, no, you can't take these junkets at business expense. You know, when Tom Corbett ran across, you know, I think he was in Brazil and he was in Germany, I think, and a couple other countries. And he was there because, you know, the business people paid the way, paid the freight. I was saying, if he's there for the good of the taxpayer, if he's good for there for the good of all of us, shouldn't we be picking up the tab? Shouldn't it be us who's paying it for, so we have, so we know what's going on? And then can question that. I mean, just a thought. I mean, because in my view, once you start accepting these things, like Nagin got himself into, how much of this turns into a blackmail scenario? You got to wonder if, and look, I don't know what went through Nagin's mind, but you got to wonder, once he was in, do you go, well, you know, I'm in. What do I do? Now, there are some that report, and you know, this is the other end of that report, that Nagin liked being mayor. He didn't actually like doing the job. Liked being on TV, liked being the star, but didn't actually like doing the actual work. And, you know, enjoyed, the limelight of being able to shuffle things around. Sad. The first mayor in New Orleans in 296 years to be convicted of corruption. First mayor in the history of the 296-year-old city. Sad. Just sad. And you know, look, I hate to see anybody fall into these pitfalls. But at the end of the day, it's like that old TV show when I was a kid, Beretta. You do the crime, you got to do the time. He's up for what they're saying is potentially upwards of 20 years. And, you know, you kind of got to go, is that a deterrent? I wonder if he's got to pay it back. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Boy, just when you think that Uber Rich couldn't get any more narcissistic or nutty, along comes Tom Perkins. He suddenly forced himself on us with a loud, self-pitying whine, which he let loose in a January letter to the Wall Street Journal. Perkins is a billionaire venture capital huckster who's not content to count his multitudinous blessings, but instead wants us to know how terribly difficult it is to be rich in America. I perceive a rising tide of hatred of the successful 1%, he wailed. If he had stopped there, he would have revealed himself as just another ridiculous old and crotchety billionaire. They do seem to be a dime a dozen these days. But Perkins has no brakes on his peevishness, so he hurtled right into the swamp of extreme nuttiness, asserting that, quote, the progressive war on the American 1% is like Nazi Germany's war on its 1%. Namely, it's Jews. I thought, surely this guy is not real. Maybe he's a made-up character in one of Stephen Colbert's satirical skits. But no, Perkins ranted on, insisting that just as anti-Semitism led to the rounding up of Jews and the hellish Kristallnacht of 1938, today's, quote, demonization of the rich would lead to a similar horror for America's wealthy minority. Yeah, Tom, we see your point. Being a billionaire is as terrible as being subjected to the Holocaust. This is Jim Hightower saying, he has since offered a lame apology to, quote, any who have mistaken my reference. But still, he's consumed by a whimpering narcissism, moaning that everyone now hates me. I don't know if Perkins has any loved ones around him, but if not, he should rent one. Someone who will gently take away his writing implements and put him in a comfortable chair in a dark, quiet room so he can be alone with his thoughts and never bother us again with any of them.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Because I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Ah, yes, the golden ticket. Yes, yes. You know, if you could just get that golden ticket, that's it's all that matters. That's it. You know, if we could win the lottery, we'd have a retirement plan. If we could get into that voucher school, we might have a shot at education. Isn't that what they keep telling us? Yet, you know, as I look at it, you know, if we had a pension plan, we wouldn't have to play the lottery in hopes that maybe we would be able to retire. Just is what it is. Anyway, a new poll out that I find interesting. The Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. They found that 83% of Americans want the country to make an effort to reduce global warming. And look, hey, we're about ready to have Snowmageddon. I'm told buckets and mounds and enormous amounts of snow are going to fall from the sky. And I think people have just about had it with this winter. These massive shifts and in the climate. And, you know, look, it doesn't take a genius to go, things are changing. Now, the question is why? And even if you can't agree, and I tend to trust the mass of the scientific community. But even if I didn't trust the mass of the scientific community, even if I said, you know, I don't believe in it, it's all a bunch of hooey, common sense would tell me that burning fossil fuel, probably not the best thing to be doing. The effects of burning stuff, not such great thing. Right? Just a thought. So when you have 83% of the country saying that we should be making an effort to reduce global warming, even if it has an economic cost, that to me is pretty substantial. It also finds out that 60% of the country thinks that we should act regardless of what anyone else does. You know, one of the arguments that I keep hearing people say, well, China won't do it. Oh, okay, so then chuck it. Then we're not going to bother, right? Just because, and I think it was Jamie Dimon who said, you know, just because we're stupid doesn't mean you have to be. And I look at it in the same way. Just because other people are stupid doesn't mean we have to. But I look at the other findings in this Yale project. They find that 57% of Democrats and 19% of Republicans believe climate change is real and should be a high and or very high priority for Congress and the president. There were areas of something that should be resembled as partisan agreement. You know, I think both groups think CO2 should be regulated as a pollutant. Now, 85% of Democrats, 55% of Republicans, still a majority. Both want to cut all fossil fuel subsidies. Democrats 67%, Republicans 52%. And look, a large number from both groups, and a fairly good sized majority from what they say, want to continue to fund and give more tax breaks and rebates for renewable energies and efficient cars because it's smart policy. Because I think most of us want, you know, less burning of things, more low carbon energy sources. And, you know, the reality is it's the direction we should be going as a nation anyway. But some of the other findings, you know, this idea that 56% would pay an extra $100 a year if it meant their electric utility was required to produce more than 20% of its electricity from renewables. Something we don't do in Pennsylvania here anymore, thanks to the Republicans who have led our General Assembly. Now, when I put my solar panels on my house, the solar renewable energy credits, the SRECs, were $225 a credit. Now, understand how it works in all over, is you have these energy companies who, as part of their portfolio of energy sales, has to have a certain percentage from renewables. Well, what happened here in Pennsylvania is they kept that number like 2%, and they didn't increase it for a number of years, and it's not going to increase for a couple more years. So what happened is, as people like me and all others across the state put solar panels on our house, you ended up with more solar energy than the minimum requirement. And the energy companies just said, well, we're only buy 2%, it's all we're buying. And the price went down to like $10, which kind of just chucked the whole system. And pretty much solar energy in Pennsylvania is done until they bring back that incentive. And, you know, I've had people say, well, we shouldn't be making them buy it. Yes, we should. we subsidize heavily the other fuels. According to the research, 72% of people want more research for renewable funding. And to me, that's fantastic. 72% of the people that they polled said, you know what? We want more investment in renewable energy. You know, and I think the more we see the Freedom Waters, the more we see these, our waterways being polluted, and this latest spill happened, I guess it was just yesterday. 100,000 gallons of this coal slurry got into the water there near Charleston, West Virginia, as if they don't have enough problems. Because remember, you know, this Freedom Water thing happened, you know, down in that area, 300,000 people cut off without water. Still, I wouldn't drink the water. And the governor says, well, drink it if you want. Don't take my word for it. That leaves me with a lot of confidence, man. But you look at the pictures from this coal slurry that ends up in the water. Now, it didn't get into the drinking water intake, so they say. But this is nasty stuff. And according to the State Department of Environmental Protection, the guy who's the secretary, he says when this much coal slurry goes into a stream, wipes the stream out. It's wiped out. It's done. Gone. So here you've lost this stream. It's done. And, you know, you look at the stuff, these toxic substances that are into it, these heavy metals, iron, magnesium, aluminum, selenium, all of these heavy metals in there, not good for your kidneys. Not good. Not good at all. But you look at that area, and I go back to when we went through on our trip. False choices. The false choice of either you allow this kind of stuff to happen. And I think the only reason that this probably got the attention that it got was because of the earlier spill. You know, and talking with people who live in West Virginia and in Tennessee and other places, you know, that have a lot of coal mining going on, this is not a rare occurrence. These kind of spills happen. And, you know, when you look at it, when you see these kind of spills going on and you go, hey, you know, how often does this have to happen before we say, no more? And then we start investing heavily in alternatives. And I saw a couple of stories that give me some hope that, you know, you look at this one that I found from, I think it was Reuters that put it out, that this guy from Germany has developed this standalone kind of solar energy generator thing. Looks like this really cool looking glass orb. Looks like, you know, like a hand holding a glass ball. And, you know, according to the story, that this guy, this architect who developed this, they're saying that it's about 35% more efficient than the standard solar panel. Because how it's shaped and that it has a tracking tool on it that will move it to the sun and that you're able to then, you know, get the maximum amount out of it, and also that because of its dimensions and because of its shape, it's able to focus a lot better. And you look at it and you go, people are making strides forward. And it's in Germany where they actually have a really strong investment policy. Now, according to the guy who makes it, he says, we want to squeeze more juice out of the sun. Now, according to the report, the amount of energy that comes from solar panels that you can get from the sun is fairly low compared to what the sun can actually produce. And according to the report, some solar panels convert only about 20% of the available energy into actual electricity. Now, there are some who are saying, because, you know, one of the knocks against solar is that, well, you know, it's only when the sun's out and you can't get it all. Well, we should be developing a way to make sure that we gain all of that. Don't you think? We should be putting a lot of money into that, much as we've done with oil over the years. Now, this guy, he's trying to raise about $120,000 through one of the Kickstart campaigns for further testing. And he's applied for some patents in the in five jurisdictions there in Germany. And it was an interesting little concept. It looks kind of cool, too. Something I don't know that I wouldn't mind having in my yard. Because I look at my solar panels, well, I think they're kind of cool. They can be unsightly if you don't like it. And I've had neighbors who, you got solar panels on your roof, I see. Yeah, good. You got your eyes checked. Congratulations. But look, with mine, we get about 40% of our electricity through a renewable source. It's a start. And at some point, the hope is that those same solar panels, if we improve, if we develop better technology, at some point, that is able to get me off the grid. That kind of investment down the future, which is why I think it's important that we invest in research and development and that we keep the technology here and the manufacturing here as well. You know, it's interesting to me that we developed the solar panel, and while the Chinese are the ones who are really benefiting from it, because they're the ones who seem to be producing like crazy. The other story I came across, Reuters put it out, that we've evidently today, scientists in this country hit what they're calling an extremely important milestone. They're saying that this decade-old, it's been numerous decades, that they've been trying to develop fusion energy. They claim it has been harnessed successfully, which means what they're saying is that they've been able to create more energy with less energy. That you put in a little, let's say you put a gallon of gas into it, it produces two. So they're really jazzed up and psyched up about it, according to Omar Hurricane, the lead physicist. According to the report, researchers have faced daunting scientific and engineering challenges in trying to develop nuclear fusion, which is, they say, the process that powers stars, including our sun, for use by humans. He says, this is really the first time anywhere that they've gotten energy out of this fuel, and it was more than they put in. He said it's quite unique. He said it's a turning point. And, unlike fossil fuels, they write, or the fission process in a nuclear plant, fusion offers the prospect of abundant energy without pollution, radioactive waste, or greenhouse gases. So, I look at this and I go, if we were investing all along and at rates, much like we put into developing the latest, greatest weapon to blow things up, we could probably be energy independent at some point in the future without real negative consequences. Now, as the article points out, unlike the current nuclear fission energy that's derived from splitting atoms, fusion energy is produced by fusing atoms together. So, the nuclear part of it is we're splitting atoms, tearing things apart. This is you're putting them together, and it's that energy that of colliding as I understand it. Now, look, this stuff is way over my head. But the fact that we've got smart people working on this and that there's a potential of maybe possibly is exciting to me. And something as a nation we should be encouraging. Instead of saying we're going to give huge, massive tax breaks to drill, baby, drill, maybe we start prioritizing on, drill, baby, drill has all of these negative connotations. Building all these pipelines have all these negative consequences. Why aren't we, as a matter of national emergency, looking at how we get to a place where we have renewable energy? And I know I've said this before, but I truly believe it's because they haven't figured out how to charge us for it yet. If there were a way to make abundant, cheap, clean energy that they could continue to charge us for, then if there were a profit motive at the end, I guarantee that it would be here already. But the problem is, like solar panels, once they put them up on your roof, once they're installed and working, they don't benefit from it. Now, understand, the ALEC people, they're trying to figure it out. What they want to do is they want to start charging people like me with solar panels to use the transmission lines that my tax dollars built, which you got to love. You got to give them credit for creativity, right? At least they're thinking. Anyway. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Have you heard about the Great Chicago Pension Caper? The Chicago Teachers Union says it's happening as Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel tries to negotiate with the union at the point of a gun. The Teachers Union says in the midst of these negotiations, Illinois State Senator John Cullerton is launching a salvo that could be the start of the Great Chicago Pension Caper. Cullerton is estimating future pension cuts for teachers. The Chicago Teachers Union says the city is threatening to lay off 3,000 teachers and raise student class sizes. The union vows to defend retirement security for educators in Chicago. The union says pensions are not gifts. They are earned through labor by workers who expect the money to be there as promised. The union says the pension problem in Illinois is a revenue problem, not an expenses problem. Chicago schools are making a budgeted pensions payment of $613 million to the pension fund by June 30th. But between 1995 and 2005, the Chicago district made no pension payments. Teachers and other municipal employees in Chicago are going to the Illinois State Capitol February 19th to, quote, encourage legislators not to raid their benefits while their wealthy corporate allies reap the financial benefits of their hard labor, end quote. Republican Tennessee U.S. Senator Bob Corker is urging VW workers in Chattanooga to vote against joining the UAW this week. Corker flip-flopped from his original public position, which was that the decision is in the hands of the workers and it would be inappropriate for him to comment until they vote. UAW Region 8 Director Gary Castile says it's sad that when workers exercise their legal right to form a union, Tennessee politicians like Corker threaten the economic well-being of communities and businesses just because workers want to have a voice in the future of Volkswagen in Chattanooga. Castile says it's unfortunate that Senator Corker has been swayed by special interests from outside of Tennessee to flip-flop on his position on what's best for Chattanooga's working families. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, are voting Wednesday through Friday on whether or not to have the UAW represent them, a vote that's expected to have a significant impact on union organizing at foreign-owned auto plants throughout the South. Castile says the decision should be left to the workers. VW is neutral on the union vote and has urged third parties to stay out of it. But right-wing anti-union groups are waging a public campaign against the VW workers joining the UAW.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Workers Independent News is the only national daily radio newscast focused on workers and their unions to help keep those voices on the radio. Donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So the snow will be coming down in droves. Yes, and from what I've, all day today, that's all I've heard people talk about. Oh, the snow's coming, we got to duck and run and cover and wow. In fact, you know, in trying to book a couple of guests in Washington, D.C., everybody evidently has left. They have left the buildings, not even just the building, they have left the area. It's something to behold, to be honest. Anyway, I've got our good friend Bob Ney from Talk Radio News Service on the line. He's, I believe, still in Washington. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm out on the road.
Okay, so you're...
I'm a chicken too.
You're heading out of Dodge.
And this happens. It helps to have a snowstorm to pass things. It really does.
And I talked about that yesterday with the passing of the debt ceiling, which I got to be honest, I was talking to Ellen yesterday, and I was saying, look, I was looking forward to the latest episode of 24. I was waiting for the ticking bomb. I was got my popcorn. We're going to the cliff. We're going to go to the mats. We're going to bring out the jugs so they can go to the bathroom and do all of that. And nothing. It was really very, very anticlimactic.
It had an amazing event. Just as somebody who was in Congress for 11 years watching things unfold, had an amazing amount of internal quick drama, I'll call it. And it started yesterday when they had the Republicans in a closed-door session, which they do across from the Capitol so they can talk about fundraising. And for 30 minutes, they were taking their turns. That's the whole conference, a couple hundred people, eating breakfast, waking up. And they're taking their turns talking about money. And after 30 minutes, John Boehner, the speaker, just kind of nonchalantly walks up, goes to the podium to, quote, give an update, and turns around and says, we're going to pass a clean debt ceiling. It's going to be good till 2015. And he stops, dead silent. And the room goes into complete silence. Not a word. Yeah, but here, a pin drop. And he looks at the crowd, and then he leaves the podium, and as he walks towards his seat, towards the back of the room, he points to one of the Tea Party guys, members of Congress, and he said, I just took the monkey off your back. You're not even going to applaud? And that's how he did it.
Wow.
Which in itself, you want to talk about in your eye. I mean, that's amazing. And then, of course, that set the stage where Ted Cruz then, President Cruz, heading to New Hampshire Cruz,
yes,
all of a sudden said, well, he's going to do this. And, you know, because this is a big fight, Rick. You know that.
Oh, absolutely.
This is the biggie for the Tea Party. And it ended up, you talk about fast guns at Dodge today, ended up the two Republicans, the two top leaders of the Senate for the Republican side, which is Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, John Cornyn of Texas. There were two votes short of that cloture rule that they have, 60 votes to bring a bill up. So it went for an hour, they kept the roll open, and those two Republicans gave the two votes, brought some others along, and then they had the cloture vote. Now, that wasn't enough. Then they turned around, and they had a vote on Ted Cruz's filibuster, where overwhelmingly he got put down, and the filibuster ended before it began. And then, on a party line vote, the desk didn't go past 55-43.
So a little bit of drama, and you know what? Amazing drama. And I would add, just on that little story you told there at the end, pretty much the reason why I don't think you're going to see a Ted Cruz presidency.
When the government, you know, Speaker Boehner got burnt, when the government shut down and then 16 days later opened up and nothing changed, they won nothing.
Right.
Because if you're going to do this, you have to win something.
Exactly. You've got to have something to take back and go, this is what it was for.
And they did with Bill Clinton when I was part of that era there in the Congress, and something was achieved. We had some balanced budgets and everybody got happy and both sides claimed some victory. So Boehner got burnt and then Boehner learned his quick lesson on that, but also what Speaker is privately saying in the Capitol is he's saving, you know, the members from themselves, and that now they can truly focus the issue and they won't be the issue.
Right.
That's what he's saying. They won't be the issue.
And I agree with that because, you know, 28 Republicans crossed over and voted for it. The rest of them that were never going to vote for it anyway, they can still go back and say, I voted against it, and continue to play on that, oh, Congress is horrible, but I'm okay angle that keeps going on in every district across this country.
And then when the government shut down and they lost on it, Boehner said one thing. The big fight is the debt ceiling. So as far as Tea Party goes, this wasn't a speed bump. This was a car crash. Because these were the issues. Now, Ted Cruz will still raise money, you know that, and he'll still beat the drum. But how far does that go till either the Tea Party themselves has to say, are we being taken for granted? Do we really have power? This speaks of a lot of political intrigue internally to see at the end of the day how they'll go from here.
Now, I got to be honest, on some level, I give Boehner credit for having the stones to make that move.
I was surprised. I thought there'd be at least maybe military tensions attached to it or something else. They had a bill on that separately, but I thought maybe that would happen. But at the end of the day, he had to have sat there this morning and thought, what am I walking into? You know, and he either could go along with it and let everybody, you know, raise their cackles, argue, or he could do some leadership movement to say, here it is.
And nobody flung eggs at him or anything?
No, not as far as I know.
You know, that's what I would have liked to have said. But, you know, anyway, we're going to move on to the, this will be till 2015, so not another episode of 24 or the hostage, no hostage situation there till next year. How about, you know, looking at actually getting some real things done for average working people? I mean, to me, there are some huge issues out there that we should be talking about. And again, all we're getting are distractions. And I look at this Keystone Pipeline thing. To me, is a massive distraction because I don't see how it's going to benefit us in this country. I know how it's going to benefit the private company in Canada. I know how that's going to help them. But I don't see how it's going to help the average consumer here in the U.S.
The problem with the whole energy scenario, first of all, we don't have an energy policy. We never have had an energy policy. We've had a reactionary policy. Also, it's an issue where the political forces don't really want to explain the issue. They really... They'll just take the snapshots that appeal to people. For example, we need more oil. We need to be off the dependence of foreign oil companies.
Right.
How do we do it? We build a Keystone Pipeline. Well, in all reality, you know, we're dependent on Beijing. They drive cars. Every day a rickshaw is turned into a car over there. So it's an entire world market. We thirst for oil over here. There's not been a refinery built since 1976. So if they bring more oil in, who refines it? That's a big question.
Yep.
Who refines the oil? And a lot of our oil is taken out and refined. So it's a very complicated picture. But I think it narrows down, not the people are fed this narrowing aspect. Here's a Keystone Pipeline. That creates jobs, and we get more oil. Boom. And they throw that out there because they really aren't going to explain the true nature of this whole energy. Puzzle.
And on the labor side of it, they, you know, they're throwing that out there. Well, this is jobs. This is all you're going to get. So either you get this or you're unemployed. Those are your options. And of course, workers are going to go, hey, I want to build something. That's what I do for a living, even if it's something that is not going to help us and, quite frankly, could be destructive.
Now, those jobs, a lot of those, I mean, jobs, I understand that people want them, but a lot of those jobs are temporary jobs. It's not going to be permanent U.S. jobs.
I understand. But even if it's a job for today, we're throwing out this false choice of this is your only option. Take it or die. Or you're going to either have this job or you're going to starve and you're not going to work. And they're pulling back unemployment and they're making people more desperate. And it's when you keep throwing out there, we're going to create 40,000 jobs. Well, for a couple months, yeah. Then what? Then you got this huge pipeline going down the middle of the country that, as I think you so aptly pointed out, is just going to be shipped into the international market and refined somewhere else, because there were three refineries in Philadelphia last year that they were going to close down. And one of them, I think they turned into one of the airline storage facilities or something along those lines. But, you know, they're still not doing the refining that they used to do.
The refinery hasn't been built, I believe, 1970. I think it is. The last one was built.
Right.
And it's a complicated, you know, puzzle, like I said, with the energy picture and what we use. So it's more easy to explain that you have that big pipe, it has a lot of oil in it, and it's really going to help us when it really will make a few rich, and it will decrease the price of gasoline. But the Senate Republicans unanimously sent the president a second letter saying do something about it. Rick, one thing I thought that was in today's news that was this just stood out to me, is that the State Department has said that this will not be adversely affecting the climate. The State Department. And I thought that was rather strange. I know this is an international deal, but I thought, you know, that really doesn't give people much confidence that the State Department says it's okay for the climate.
No.
They're not
the and what's the and where do they get the expertise in this?
No, that's what wasn't explained. It's just simply that the state has said this will not be a harmful factor in climate.
Now, are they assuming that it's going to get done anyway, even if it goes, if it's done in Canada and eventually, or if it's done on rails through the country, and it's going to happen anyway, so we might as well, because I've heard that argument. What's going to happen anyway, Rick? You know, business is going to do what business is going to do, and you're just going to have to like it, so it's going to happen anyway. You might as well like it. It's like that guy who ran for governor in Texas who said if you're going to get raped, you might as well just lay back and enjoy it. Kind of the same thing, I'm assuming, right?
It must be because it just looks like they're building the case to do it, no matter what. You know, they're going to build a case.
Well, this is why you have to have strong opposition. I saw Janet Yellen testified yesterday to Congress, and I like her. I got to be honest, for the first time and probably in my lifetime, there's been a Fed chair who I think is going to be doing the other part of what the Federal Reserve should be doing, and that's promoting full employment policy.
And you know, I know she wasn't, you know, originally the top of the food chain progressive choice, but I think she's going to be liked. And the alternative would have been really awesome.
Not Larry Summers.
Yeah, it had been a disaster and of epic, to editorialize, of epic proportion had it been Larry Summers. And Janet Yellen will take more of the administration's point of view anyway on the economy, but I think you're right. With her testimony, she came off as somebody, you know, that's not going to be terrified, is not going to jump to conclusions, and is going to be one who will look at the what the charter, what it's supposed to do, to look at the employment side of things, which, you know, for a while it never did.
Yeah. I mean, you go back to Volcker, the number one thing in the late 70s was holding down inflation, didn't care what it did to jobs, and caused a massive jobs deficit, and they did their job. They got inflation under control, even if it did mean lots of pain for people, and they've been single-mindedly focused on that, in my view, ever since. Yeah, I'm hopeful. And look, when it wasn't Larry Summers, I actually did a hooray. Yeah, that's fantastic. Finally, he didn't get the job that he wanted. So you can't fail upwards all the way to the top, just mostly to the top.
He, you know, he went after it full force, and Wall Street rallied around him and pushed very, very hard in every way possible up on the hill.
Well, I mean, he does have a record of failing at everything that they've done.
Everything.
Yeah.
Not a few, but everything.
Everything.
Also, he really wasn't copacetic with the administration's thinking anyway on the economy. So it would have been a nightmare.
And finally, I see that, you know, everyone, you know, whether you think as I do that people like Snowden and Manning are heroes in my eyes, that they've shed light and place in dark places that we may have thought but never really knew. I hear. We've really, as a matter of the country, haven't done anything to make sure that the next Manning or Snowden or doesn't happen.
You're right. And it's been revealed, and of course we have a head of Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, and he has said that point blank, after Snowden mined or scraped the information, as they call it, that no controls were put in place for almost a year to prevent that from happening. And the interesting thing about that is this is a government agency that says, look, we had to gather information. We needed to do it to make you safe. I mean, you've talked about this on your show so many times. And at the end, they say, but, you know, trust us. We've secured things. Well, it wasn't secured. And, yes, Snowden was able to bring to light, fortunately, and I agree with you, things that we need to know how they were doing the processes. And on top of it, the very people that say, trust us, your things are safe with us, after Snowden never put any additional types of technological changes, so other things could have been taken by any other contractor.
Yeah.
And under the sun, they could do the same thing.
Yeah, and maybe there'll be another, depending on what happens to Snowden, maybe there'll be a line of them. Who knows? And, you know, I talked with Ellen yesterday, and she pointed out that Elijah Cummings had accused one of the security firms who were supposed to be doing background checks of basically defrauding the government of about $1 billion and not actually doing the checks. So you're telling me the window's open. They haven't really done anything to stop, you know, something like Snowden did. And we've got we're paying a security firm to do clearance checks on people that they're not actually doing. You kind of got to go where the right wing has been going. Government doesn't seem to work very well. It's hard to make the argument that they're wrong in some of these situations.
Yes, and the security checks, as we know now, are just basically ridiculous in a lot of ways. They're not done well. You know, we're paying contractors to do them. But I think the overall point is the agency, you know, tells us Snowden's a bad guy, shouldn't have done this. He's the, you know, the bad one in this. We're here to protect you, but they never, quote, protected us again for anybody to be able to mind this for a year's period of time. So it could be out there in the hands of many people.
It'll be interesting. But you know who I'm sure the security firm did do a background check on? This guy. Because I have a CDL. I have a commercial driver's license, a federal driver's license. That's right. Truck drivers in this country have a commercial federal driver's license. And as someone who holds one of these federal commercial driver's license, I have to submit myself to a terrorism risk assessment. And I had to go, and I'm still fuming about this. I had to go to the UPS store to get my fingerprints taken. I'm giving my fingerprints to somebody who's probably making like $12 an hour working behind the counter at a UPS store. Not even part of our government now has control of my fingerprints.
Oh, that's amazing. I had no idea it went that far. That's amazing.
And, you know, so when you bring up these security firms are bilking us out of $1 billion and cheating us left and right, I go, you know what? I just got cheated out of $60 because I needed someone to tell me in order to have a hazardous material endorsement on my license that I'm not a terrorist. And again, because I've had to give them my fingerprints a couple of times, I got to give them to them again.
And the local business has your fingerprint.
Yeah, and I'm going, maybe. It's
that
insane to me.
That makes me shiver.
As it should, and I'm going, do I really want this license? And I guess it's not going. It's going to be one of those things until truck drivers start turning the truck sideways on the roads, and we the people say no more. But here again, you know, thanks George W. Bush. This is what came out of the Patriot Act for me.
The next insult will be going to Walmart to have to do that. That would be the total insult.
That's exactly it. Bob, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thanks, sir.
Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Boy, just when you think the uber rich couldn't get any more narcissistic or nutty, along comes Tom Perkins. He suddenly forced himself on us with a loud, self-pitying whine, which he let loose in a January letter to the Wall Street Journal. Perkins is a billionaire venture capital huckster who's not content to count his multitudinous blessings, but instead wants us to know how terribly difficult it is to be rich in America. I perceive a rising tide of hatred of the successful 1%, he wailed. If he had stopped there, he would have revealed himself as just another ridiculous, old, and crotchety billionaire. They do seem to be a dime a dozen these days. But Perkins has no brakes on his peevishness, so he hurtled right into the swamp of extreme nuttiness, asserting that, quote, the progressive war on the American 1% is like Nazi Germany's war on its 1%, namely its Jews. I thought, surely this guy is not real. Maybe he's a made-up character in one of Stephen Colbert's satirical skits. But no, Perkins ranted on, insisting that just as anti-Semitism led to the rounding up of Jews in the hellish Kristallnacht of 1938, today's, quote, demonization of the rich would lead to a similar horror for America's wealthy minority. Yeah, Tom, we see your point. Being a billionaire is as terrible as being subjected to the Holocaust. This is Jim Hightower saying, he has since offered a lame apology to, quote, any who have mistaken my reference. But still, he's consumed by a whimpering narcissism, moaning that everyone now hates me. I don't know if Perkins has any loved ones around him, but if not, he should rent one, someone who will gently take away his writing implements and put him in a comfortable chair in a dark, quiet room, so he can be alone with his thoughts and never bother us again with any of them.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So much going on, and the snow has begun to fall. I saw a truck plow go by, and hey, bud, thanks. Appreciate it. Going to make my ride home that much safer. And look, if you're out on the roads tonight, by all means, take it easy, slow down. You know, last weekend I was out, you know, driving when a little bit of snow, just a little bit, hit the road. And I've always had this theory, you got two groups of people. When the snow starts flying, two groups. You got the one group who doesn't know it's snowing, and they're doing 120 miles an hour like they would be doing anyway. Then the other group is completely, totally scared to death that it is. That it's snowing. And the two of those groups at some point down the road, generally in front of me, they meet and cause a massive backup. Last weekend I had said it would be nice to own a tow truck because I counted 20 cars that had found themselves off onto the side of the road because, well, they were going too fast for conditions. So by all means, please slow down. Make it home safely. Plow drivers, thank you for the work that you're doing, keeping our roads open and making sure that folks are safe. I can't stress that enough. And it doesn't happen enough. In my view, in our society, we don't thank the public servants who do so much work to keep us moving and going and the roads open so I can get home. Thank you. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, all of that. Going through some quick changes here at the program. So the website, we're still working out the bugs, but I would love to hear your thoughts, your questions, your comments. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. It's been a great night. Thanks for being here. As always, appreciate our folks tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a good night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the